area of HD1 Detroit.
Now,
this is Night Call, Detroit's longest running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 248-544-WRIF. That's 248-544-9743. Or text the RIF at 4WRIF. That's 49743. Night Call is on the air. Here are your hosts, Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome, everybody. Welcome to the broadcast. I'd like to hear from you, specifically, you.
Yes, you.
You know why I said then?
Why?
Because they tell you in broadcasting school, you're not supposed to say everyone.
Speak to
you're supposed to, I'm just speaking to
individual.
You.
Individual.
Just you. You
it's
and you,
you
alone.
You and me, baby.
Yeah, there is nobody else there listening except you. All right. So you, give us a call at 248-544-WRIF.
248-544-9743. Brand new phone number. Brand new fancy phone system,
and
you can text us, and we figured out how to retrieve the text. We're on a roll, Peter.
We are 21st century, big time. It's 4WRIF 49743, and to make everything even more confusing, and this is something I haven't even told Jalene,
but
that we have our old email address back.
Oh, we do?
Because Gmail just went south. Don't ask. Don't even ask. But it's called Talk Yes. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. And if I can find out how to retrieve the Gmail messages, maybe I can respond to some of you. So
if not,
just don't ask.
Just forget about it. Let's forget the whole thing.
A lot of action going on our Facebook page, Facebook.com/Night Call. Also my website, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. And I want, Jillian, I want you to have, or is that just 20th century?
What?
Websites.
What you want me to have what?
Yeah, a website.
What would I put on it?
All your songs? And
no.
No?
No.
Okay. All right. Now, this is about you. I'm not talking to Julie. No, no. This is about you, the listener. We'd like you to call in. We're going to talk about some stuff and would like you to call in. Now, the president went on television, said there were, which has now become probably the word of the week, glitches in the new Obamacare sign-up protocols, the website and all
yeah.
of that.
Yeah, and which we coined that word in regards to this website weeks ago.
You think we made it up?
Well,
I think
we're always on to something, Peter.
We are on the cutting edge of cliches. Well, here's what I was thinking about. Because Jalene and I and so many of you think that everyone deserves, and you can call up about that if you don't like my verb, deserves adequate health care. We have the best health care in the world, but the worst health care system in terms of advanced industrialized countries. We're the only one without a national health care program, and this one is all based around private industry, and you would think that the conservatives, would be delighted with it, because it's like RomneyCare in Massachusetts. This essentially was devised by the conservative think tank Heritage Foundation. But it has had immense problems, and people have had difficulty signing up. And I've heard, and I have no way to corroborate this, because it seems only to come from right-wing sources, that the middle class is actually going to wind up paying more than they are now. If that happens, it's going to sink the Dems and the program and everything big time. Now, I think what I started to say was I think Jalene and I and so many of you favor this because of two reasons. One, we think people deserve health care as almost a matter of right. Or
better
if not,
than adequate health care.
Okay, better than adequate health care. Why should there be one system of health care for the rich and another one, a horribly inadequate one for
everyone else,
mm-hmm. or particularly the poor? And the other reason, it's almost reflexive. I hate to say it because, you know, I'm supposed to be thinking about these things. I'm not supposed to be reacting reflexively. But it's like if the right wing and the conservatives are against it, you almost reflexively say, well, they are always wrong about everything. So naturally, we are supportive of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Now, who would say, other than these right-wing conservatives, to repeal Obamacare? That has been their mantra. They took the country, they being the cons, the conservatives.
Ted Cruz and
company.
Friends.
Yeah, and these nutballs in the House of Representatives took the country to the brink of financial disaster because they wanted to get rid of Obamacare. And it was they were just in this fascist froth about it. It wasn't once in a while they'd say, oh, you know, because the we can't afford it or something like that. But it's the idea. Well, you know, they talk about compassionate care. They're sort of on the opposite, you know.
You mean another one of these kind of twists of the word?
Yeah,
to make it sound nice?
Yeah. No, it was compassionate conservative. That's what. That was the George Bush thing, right?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So long
Remember
ago.
Remember him?
So many evil people ago.
Yes. You know, people actually say that looking back, you know, that they look back on the good old days with George Bush Republic.
Please.
Yeah, yeah.
Please. Right. I will never say that. Okay. Ever.
Russell McIver, who is the founder of Single Payer Action. Single payer means essentially socialized medicine for everyone. And you're for socialized medicine, everyone, right? Is there anyone not for socialized medicine? You give us a call at 248-544-WRIF. Well, okay, maybe you don't want socialized medicine for everybody, but you want socialized medicine for a lot of our citizens, right? You want it for our aged.
Yeah.
That would be Medicare. And you want it for our veterans, right?
Yes.
That's socialized medicine. And you want it for the disabled,
yes,
right? Yes. Then when you start talking about giving it to the poor people.
Oh, yeah,
Medicaid.
Women, those pesky women and those pesky and little children.
14 children.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
That's what they say.
You know, they have those children just so they can get Medicaid.
That's
for them.
That's one of those.
Yeah, it's a little circular, right? They have children so they can get the children on Medicaid. Anyway, so who would say repeal Obamacare? Well, Russell McIver, the founder of Single Payer Action. Single payer means that it would be the government that would be provide health care in the way that all the other industrial countries do. Here's what he said, and this is unfortunate, and this goes back to what I'm saying about the support that most liberals and people left of center, lefties in general, give to Obamacare. But Russell McIver says complexity is baked into Obamacare and is thus doomed to fail.
Well, we've predicted certain levels of failure upon which would create changes, which is what our hope is.
Well, that'd be the hope, yeah. And also, the conservatives are doing everything they can to make it fail. If they said, okay, we don't agree with this, but this provides health care at least at some level for millions of people that are without it, and we're going to do everything we're going to do our darndest to make sure that this works out all right, and we're going to introduce legislation that would fix the problems instead of trying to make it worse so it fails. But here's what McIver said. Complexity is baked into Obamacare and is thus doomed to fail.
This is interesting.
You have this too. When Medicare was rolled out in 1966, there were no computers. More than 20 million people were enrolled, elderly, of course, enrolled over 6 months on index
cards. Oh, my God.
You gotta love it. Repeal Obamacare, says this left-of-center advocate for single-payer health care, Russell McIver. He says, replace with single-payer, simple, secure, stable, no co-pays, no deductibles, control costs, and we'll get to that in a little while.
No more deaths due to lack of health insurance.
No more medical bankruptcies. And important, everybody in, nobody out.
Free choice of hospital and doctor. I mean,
Don't run over that last one. Say that again slowly and emphatically.
Free choice of hospital and doctor.
Yeah.
My friend had a baby in London, and she went in, she had a baby, and she left with the baby. That was it.
And how much did she pay?
Nothing.
Yeah, right.
Nothing.
That's called single payer. But people, well, that's the government doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, and let's go through the long list of really, 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 really bad things the government does.
Absolutely. Let's see here. There's a couple of you waiting, but let me talk about another thing because I got to get this out of Jalene's system, or she will take it out. She will take it on in you guys. And have we had a woman call in the last 4 weeks or so? Maybe we ought to do that. We ought to have a line for men and a line for women.
We have six lines.
Yeah.
It's equal opportunity.
Okay, 248-544-WRIF. Sergeant Pepper Spray. Yeah, I made that up.
That was good, Peter.
Yeah, Sergeant
nice
Pepper
one.
Spray. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, Sergeant Pepper Spray, John Pike was a former campus cop at UC Davis, California. Go ahead, you take it from
Most
there.
People know him as Lieutenant Pike, and yeah. He was the one who's so ever so casually pepper sprayed the students who were sitting ever so peacefully on a sidewalk during a protest. And so then he did get fired from his job.
Right.
The protesters did get $30,000 apiece, but Lieutenant Pike decided, well, oh, this was very stressful and it caused me distress. And so I'm going to sue for that. They gave that $38,000.
That
Yes. Yes. They for what? For what?
Hey, you know, I thought you were supposed to be compassionate. You make fun of conservatives because they're not authentically compassionate. Here was a man who said that he faces continuing significant internal and external stress with respect to resolving and solving the significant emotional upheavals that have occurred after he pepper sprayed, essentially a felonious assault, I would say. He's lucky he didn't get prosecuted. Because he did this
lucky.
For no, and I don't know if people remember. People just remember this iconic photo of this. What do they call it? Actually, I have it here.
Well, there were photos all over social media of him pepper spraying everything from Van Gogh paintings to The Last Supper to the Maria from The Sound of Music, which I really
This one up. This is from Our Tax Dollars at Work. And what they've done, photoshopped, and there is the Beatles, except they've taken out Ringo, and instead they have Lieutenant Pike pepper spraying Paul as they cross Abbey Road. You know, the one where he's barefoot and everything.
I've seen that one. There were a lot of good ones. That was the only sense of relief I got was from watching all of these, because it exploded all over the internet. I say we bring it back. And bring him down.
You know what? This is a great focal point for indignation properly. This guy pepper spraying these students who were
21
unarmed.
21 of them.
Yeah, they were completely unarmed. They were completely peaceful. And you know what heinous crime they were doing? They were blocking a sidewalk.
Sidewalk, I know.
I mean, they're lucky they didn't sick the dogs on them. Or maybe, what are those things? Water cannons.
Yeah, yeah.
Or
rubber bullets.
I forgot about those.
Hey, we could have brought out the tanks.
And they got something like MABP or something, the sound cannon.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
Yeah, why not?
Why not?
Well, if one of the things he has, Lieutenant Pike, who is called Hero to Zero. I like that. Hero to Zero.
He is a big zero.
And the headline in Our Tax Dollars at Work, and this is from when it happened in, I think, late 2011, douchebag University of California Davis police officer John Pike, honored for service prior to brutal pepper spray attack on peaceful protesters, that he has a helmet on and a face mask.
And he has full gear.
He doesn't have full, or does he?
No,
because the other guys do. They are what we call militarized police. Some of them, which I was, I thought I remembered. If it didn't happen at UC Davis with these Occupy, it happened at other places. That the police and university police came out with fully automatic weapons, flak vests, and what have you. I mean, this is a horrible precedent.
Yes.
I mean, there has been so much death at the hands of police in the past, I think it was 1 BC or something like that. It's an outrage that, what's odd. I mean, I'm more outraged at the equipment. And this is, of course, what happens. I mean, when the people that you're supposed to be serving are identified as the enemy, that you need to dress in battle gear like you were in Iraq or Afghanistan, well, mainly pepper spraying them seems to be pretty low level.
And the thing about this particular pepper spraying is when we're talking about pepper spraying of this magnitude, these are big, large canisters. It's not like the little thing of mace that I have on my keychain.
Yeah.
This goes blasting out. And if you've ever had the joy of being pepper sprayed, as Peter and I have, at least, you know, wafting toward us, it is extremely, extremely painful. And I remember how it just kind of stuck in our throats for days and days. So these kids, essentially, were pepper sprayed Right. I mean, it was within how many feet? Just a few feet. He was right there.
Oh, yeah.
And we've had it. We've been running away from it, usually.
At the time, it said the police officer who pepper sprayed a row of peaceful Occupy Wall Street protesters at a California university last week, which was 2011, is a retired U.S. Marine sergeant who has been honored for his police work on campus, but he's also figured in a discrimination lawsuit against the university. Now, so you start seeing this pattern here. Now, as one of four lieutenants, the 39-year-old supervises, this is in the past.
Being discriminated against?
No. Let me see. Footage of Pike and other officer clad in riot gear carefully spraying an orange cloud at protesters' heads has sparked national outrage. Pike has been honored by the university for exceptional police work, including a 2006 incident in which he tackled a scissor-wielding hospital patient who was threatening fellow officers. Well, that's good. Afterwards, he said he decided against using pepper spray because it might harm his colleague or other hospital patients.
Oh, really?
This I did not know. So here is, what did I say, this douchebag cop, hero to zero, he sprays these students that are paying to go there, so essentially he's being paid to protect them. He pepper sprays them in the face, but he actually risked bodily harm earlier by deciding not to pepper spray somebody who's trying to hurt people because of he doesn't want to hurt other patients. But here.
Yeah, makes no sense.
But an alleged anti-gay slur by Pike also figured in a racial and sexual discrimination lawsuit a former police officer filed against the department, which ended in $250,000 settlement in 2008. Calvin Chang's 2003 discriminated, and then he describes it. He said he was systematically marginalized as a result of anti-gay and racist attitudes on the force, and he specifically claimed Pike described him using a profane anti-gay epithet. So when you see this behavior, then it's not surprising then that he did what he did.
Yeah, exactly.
Essentially assaulted people. All right, let's get a couple of your calls. And one of the things we were talking about, and still we are looking for the person that has signed up for Obamacare successfully. Or unsuccessfully.
Because many have. Many have signed up successfully.
Yeah.
There was a story about, I can't remember what state it was, that in the South somewhere, actually, where the governor was saying it's been a great success so far.
Right. All right. Let's see. Here is Justin and Warren. And Justin wants to talk about health care. Justin, hi. You're on the air. If I have this going, I'm not sure I do. Justin, are you there? No.
Yeah, I'm here. How
okay,
you doing?
Good, good. I worked it out. We got a new phone system. What's up?
I partially agree with you about the Obamacare thing. I mean, it is true that we need to have people getting health care. That's major. We can't have people without health care, but do we really need to tax somebody who doesn't want it $750 every 3 months for not having it?
No, that's not a
it's not going to.
No, it's $95 a year.
Or 1% of your income. You got to have one of the things that is the deal with this. You got to have everybody in it, the costs are unmanageable. So, yeah, I don't think anybody should have to pay anything. I mean, we already have the tax base through which to have a national health care plan, essentially Medicare for all, simply by shifting, say, I don't know, at least half of, we wouldn't even need that, half of the so-called defense budget to our domestic needs, because that's a transfer of wealth, that's the use of our tax money, but instead it goes trillions, not billions, but trillions of dollars out the door, down the rat hole of corrupt defense spending and, sending it over to warlords in Afghanistan. So the money's there, it's just coming from the wrong place, I'd say.
Exactly. You're absolutely right. Now, I'm just going to veer off the subject, if you don't mind.
Sure, go ahead.
Look at Syria. Okay, the only people who voted to go to war in Congress on Syria were paid off by the defense companies. I mean, look at John McCain, for example. He got $195,000 just for a vote to go to war with Syria. That's unbelievable.
Well, you know what I would like to do, though, and this is nothing I can do right now. Maybe you could even do it. I'm willing to bet that almost every member of Congress, mm-hmm. Democrat and Republican, is, feeding off of that trough. That's how, that's how they keep it. I mean, that's why it's a military industrial political complex.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
Big time.
When was it that it started happening that politicians we're getting paid off.
1 BC. I believe. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Let's go to Brian. Brian's in California. Where are you in California, Brian?
Hey, I'm in Palm Springs. Peter, how are you doing tonight?
We're well. What's up?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm 62 years old. I'm from Detroit originally. I was with John, you know, carrying equipment with him, John Sinclair, that is.
All right.
I've been around for a little while. I was roadie for Iggy and the guys and everything. But we're out here on hiatus with the Detroit 420 show. And that's my little web show here I had on Facebook. We thought we'd give a thumbs up out there and say you've been rocking and rolling all weekend. Sounds really good. And, of course, we'd like to always get involved in these talks about, you know, medical health insurance and stuff. I was a veteran. I am a veteran myself. And, like I say, we don't get adequate coverage in the VA, never mind what Obama's offering right now.
Yeah, it's true. And that's a crime right there.
Sure. Sure.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But, I see some atrocities going on at the Detroit Vet Center. I live there 6 months of the year, 7 months of the year, right there downtown Detroit, right in front of the Vet Center, in fact. And I see people coming home with staples in them and bleeding to death the next day and all kinds of things that you wouldn't believe it. The insurance, the care there is worse, I think, there than any place I've ever seen. I mean, I've gone to Loma Linda out here in L.A. VA.
Well, you know what, O'Brien? The vets I know, they give it. I've heard both ways. Three particular vets that give it real high marks, including an older guy, you know, that's got some pretty bad cancer, and he's pretty happy. But just sort of the general stuff. Then on the other hand, I do hear some
stories like this.
Stories like yours.
Like you're telling us.
You know what, though? It could be that it's like anything. You know, some people think, a particular doctor is a miracle worker, but if he doesn't cure you, you think he's a quack, right?
Yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
And some doctors really are bad. You know, you get
that's why they say get a second opinion.
Yeah, get a second opinion. All right, thank you very much.
Well, Brian, sounds like you've had quite an interesting life. Thanks for calling the show. Call again.
Bye-bye. let's see. Well, I forgot now. I remember how to get rid of it. Yeah, right. You got to press. We got a new phone system, folks. Anyway, Russell McIver, a lefty, says repeal Obamacare. Replace it with single payer, simple, secure, staple.
Can you imagine how crazy those teabaggers would go if that was even...
Right.
Talked about. I mean, there's only maybe three Congress people in the entire congressional, group that would even think about single payer.
Well, the problem is like it's not fundable right now. As long as we're wasting the amount of money we do on the military. And the military,
yes.
And you know, this phrase that we kind of hear and people know, I think, what it means, you know, the military-industrial complex.
It means big business.
Yeah, it means that war is good business. It means that that these defense contractors who get hundreds of millions of dollars to build these weapons and that quickly become obsolete, and some of which we're selling to countries overseas and what have you.
And they use them in ways that...
Well,
none of us would approve of.
And then what happens is these companies, these corporations, these defense contractors are entwined in every single state in the union. And they do that purposely. So they've got this in your district and that in his district and another one in her district. And so it's not like a congressperson can say, I think we ought to get rid of this facility, because then, boom, all of a sudden you've lost 800 jobs in your district.
Then people won't vote for you.
Yeah. So this
is ugly stuff.
Yeah. So it's the military-industrial political complex, and as I guess it was Jim said from Warren, is then that, and then they provide the bucks to keep these weapons systems going.
Justin.
Yeah. Justin?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Anyway, Russell McIver says we ought to have essentially Medicare for all. Everybody in, nobody out. Philip Caper, who is a doctor in Portland, Maine, he writes for the Bangor Daily News. He wrote, the high cost of complexity in healthcare reform. He says the problem with the Affordable Care Act is not that the federal government is involved, but that literally thousands of private insurers have their fingers in the cookie jar, resulting in a law that is much too complicated for what it needs to accomplish and too complex for anybody to administer efficiently and effectively. That's really frightening for everybody that wants this law to be, to be successful. And I would be really remiss, and I think some of these liberal talk show hosts on television are being remiss in just trying to say, oh, you know, everything is fine with this, and we just got to clean up the website, and everything will be cool.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things we've said...
I mean, that'd be a good start.
What?
Fix the website.
Oh, yeah. Right.
You know, let's start there.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe... Oh, get this. These cons, the conservatives, they are all about conspiracies, always, right?
Yeah.
And some of the worst ones have disappeared, fortunately.
Well, there are some just really far-reaching.
How about this? Obama has purposely set up the Affordable Care Act to fail. So then...
These guys are so ridiculous.
Then... After this collapses because it doesn't work and everything goes wrong with it, he'll say, see, we need a single-payer system with government health care.
Wow.
Oh, that it was true.
I know, really. I mean, I wish that was one conspiracy that came to
I guess I'm not really clear why people would oppose a Medicare for everyone system.
Well, because those people are lazy. Just go get a job now.
Well, that would just, I mean, nobody expects that to, we always fall into that
accent. We apologize.
Yeah.
I work my butt off and I don't have health insurance. So, you know, what does that say?
So that would be good for you.
It would be wonderful.
And it'd be wonderful for like 40 million people. But one of the things, and I may have said it on the show before, you say, well, you don't have any problem with people 65 and older getting Medicare, do you? And nobody but the most insane libertarian wants to get rid of that, right? Send the elderly back to the poorhouse.
My God.
And hospitals for the indigent and all that. I mean, Medicare...
They're all closed.
Yeah, Medicare particularly, but Medicare and Social Security is what essentially keeps the majority of senior citizens out of poverty.
Completely. And out of the grave.
Right. Oh, yeah. So one thing I say to people, well, you don't object to Medicare, do you? Well, no, they are our senior citizens. Well, good. How about if you reduced it to 64?
Yeah. So you could get it earlier.
Yeah, just 1 year earlier. I mean, those are folks getting on in their years, you know, your folks or your grandfolks or you.
And think about the people who are getting let go from jobs because of the economy and a lot more people in that age range are losing their gigs.
So what about, so then you could say you start dropping down. What about 63, 62? What about if you started Medicare?
60.
Or what about 55? What about 1 month? Right? So what's the difference between giving medical government financed medical care to someone who's 22 or someone that's 72? Well, what's the deal? I don't get it. And it's really good. It's really good for the economy. It's really good for individuals. It's
believe it or not, it really is.
Yeah.
And, you know, it makes me want to YouTube Bruce Springsteen, We Take Care of Our Own.
There you go.
Because that's what we need to do.
Yeah. Also, Dr. Caper says, together, Medicare and... Oh, here, I wondered. I say, how come I'm so smart? I thought of this. No, I guess I just read this. Together, Medicare and Social Security, both run by the federal government, have been successful providing access to private health care, pardon me, and income security for millions of seniors and the disabled for almost 50 years. They have been a major factor in keeping seniors out of our country,
out of poverty.
We need expanded and improved Medicare for all. We need to vote any politician who won't advance us towards that goal out of office.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I think they're onto something here.
Ponder that. We'll be back, and this will be our crime blotter. the banksters.
And your phone calls.
Yeah, and your phone calls.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. The weekend is brought to you by the Arsenio Hall Show. Watch weeknights at 11 on CW50. The Rick.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
So, what does it feel like to get the greatest haircut on earth at Lady Jane's in Brighton? What does a soothing shampoo, scalp massage, and a hot lather neck shave feel like? Well, you know when the stud running back on your fantasy football team tweaks his knee, and all you have left is that inferior player? Then out of nowhere, he goes off for 200 yards and 3 touchdowns? That's what it feels like to get the greatest haircut experience on earth at Lady Jane's in Brighton, on Grand River Ave, in the Brighton Mall. Lady Jane's, it's wicked awesome.
It's football season at Buffalo Wild Wings, and there's no other place that packs in the action like we do. When there's a timeout during a game, you're watching another game. And when you're not watching that game, you're watching another game. With over 50 big screens, your eyes won't miss any of the action, and neither will your taste buds. You'll enjoy hand-spun wings in 16 signature sauces and 5 seasonings, ultimate nachos, burgers, and over 20 beers on draft. Maybe action-packed is a bit of an understatement.
Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Each year, millions of baseball fans cheer for the home team. And it takes everyone playing as a team to get the win.
Listen, baseball's all about teamwork. Major League ballplayers know to be safe at home, they have to work together. As a fan, teamwork means being responsible and getting your friends and family home safely to and from the ballpark. So always wear your safety belt and use a sober-designated driver. Find out how you can win tickets to the World Series or a trip to the All-Star Game by visiting the designated driver booth at a Major League ballpark. Because responsibility has its rewards.
A message from Team Coalition.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. You've got it on the award-winning Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
Whoa, this music just makes me...
It makes me want to go to a club and dance.
Absolutely. Hey, I just saw a pretty good movie last night. We saw The Fifth Estate, not to be confused with that radical underground Detroit newspaper.
That's awesome paper.
That still publishes at fifthestate.org. Not to be confused with the new movie with Benedict Cumberbatch.
And he plays Julian Assange.
Yeah, for the WikiLeaks guy that, remember Bradley Manning, now Chelsea Manning? Chelsea brought out these, hundreds of thousands of, it was hundreds of thousands of diplomatic cables, battlefield reports, all of that. And Julian Assange and WikiLeaks exposed all of this to the consternation of the government. Assange himself, this movie, which is now playing around town and is the story of all that, and is pretty compelling. At some parts, when it's just got music like we just heard and there's just all this computer code flashing in the screen, I'm thinking, okay, come on. I know you're just filling to get to another
to the
part.
Meat.
Yeah, I know there's a little sex. Okay, come on. You know, okay, great. Get it over with.
Well, so, he did have a little incident involving sex.
They didn't have that.
They didn't put that in there?
They put that at the end. Assange, Julian Assange, read the first script and said, this is an anti-WikiLeaks film. This is part of promoting war with Iran. And actually, the filmmakers changed a lot of it.
Good.
And I don't want to give anything away, but to some extent, Assange gets the last word.
Does he really?
In this film.
He is a strange-looking one, isn't he?
And Benedict Cumberbatch,
yeah,
who also, I think, maybe is at PBS, plays Sherlock Holmes, a wonderful actor.
Very strange looking.
And when I see Assange now, I see Cumberbatch.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they picked a good person to do the part.
Only in England could you have somebody named Benedict Cumberbatch.
I love it. So should I go see it? Or
I'd say, no, I recommend it.
Okay.
Yeah, I recommend it. It's pretty good. But on to the banksters. I said last, when Kwame Kilpatrick, the ex-mayor of of Detroit. I remember that. Yeah. I was looking for my kicker line.
Here. Okay.
I said that white people hadn't been so happy since the Tigers won the division championship.
You sure did.
Yeah, yeah. But 28 years seemed extraordinarily excessive.
A little harsh.
A little harsh.
I think so.
But most sentences in the United States are overly harsh compared to the rest of the world.
Well, wait. Let's think about the countries where they cut your hand
I'm
off.
I'm sorry. I should say industrialized Western countries. Okay. Most all countries in the West have abolished capital punishment. But not us, not Iran, not China, places like
they
that.
They do some pretty bad,
they do
some bad things to people.
But I think there's a few Western countries that retain it, like Japan, oddly enough, but they execute very, very few people.
Okay.
And the harsh punishment seemed to have no effect on the level of crime because we have the highest crime rate and the highest incarceration rate in the world. And also, the United States routinely executes innocent people. There's been almost 150 people freed from death row over the last, I forget how many years. But
the DNA has proven that they are innocent. What's the word for it? Help me.
Bad.
Well,
that's not good.
It's unforgivable.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, even somebody that commits a monstrous crime like Anders Breivik, who killed 77 young people in Norway because they were leftist youth. Actually, they were part of what's called a Social Democratic Party there, and they were at an island resort, and he just...
He lost his mind.
He got 21 years. Now, the response here isn't that Kwame Kilpatrick should have got 19 years because Anders Breivik got 21, but rather they should have executed Anders Breivik. But they have a sense of what humanity is, and nothing's going to bring back those 77 kids. And you could torture Anders Breivik to death, and it would, like they used to during the Middle Ages, and nothing would remove that ghastly harm to the fabric of Norwegian society. But one of the reasons, and we talked about this last week, but later in the show, that some of you may remember, and Jelena will remember, that one of the reasons the federal sentencing judge for Kwame Kilpatrick, I know a lot of you know him personally and call him Kwame, I don't, so I just call him either Kilpatrick or if I call him Kilpatrick, you think I'm talking about some Irish baseball player or something like that. Kwame Kilpatrick is that he did so much harm to the city of Detroit, that he deserved that given the fact that he was one of the factors in sinking the city. I think that's a hard argument to make. He sure didn't help it. And but
he did damage.
He did damage, but not significantly. I mean, the damage was done, as even the Detroit News has said, the damage began half a century ago.
And this was, his whole deal was more just helping his friends out. You know, it was more kind of inner workings between people.
Yeah, he got money from the contractors and what have you. I mean, if there would have been positive leadership, would things have gone better? Perhaps, but it's a long, complicated story. Anyway, some of you may remember Bernard Madoff. He had this what's called a Ponzi scheme, P-O-N-Z-I, and that is he was essentially looting the money that was given to him by investors. He ran this investment firm, and he promised this enormous return on investment, something like up to 25%. And
he was brilliant at it, too.
And the thing is that he took money. This is why I hate him so much. He took money from Peter to pay Paul.
Oh, gosh.
So in other words, that Paul had invested, let's just say, $100, and he told him, well, we're going to get you $125 in 6 months. So then I would say, oh, God, that's great. So I'm going to, here's my $100. So he would take, the money from me to make
more money?
These guys. I hate money.
I do, too.
Yeah. He would take the money that was secondarily invested to pay off the first guy in terms of the high interest.
It's kind of like when For example, people who go to these check cashing places and then just get further and further and further behind and can't, you know,
except this, on a small level. Except this is going upwards the other way.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
As long as you keep getting people involved, you can keep people paying below. But it almost always collapses, as this original Ponzi scheme did.
And it was wiped out an estimated $17 billion in cash for his investors. Paper losses reached more than $64 billion.
I never understand that verb, though, lost. Remember, we've talked about this before. Where did it go? It either had to go somewhere. Sometimes things just aren't, their value is lost. In other words, if you have a bunch, that's why these people talk about having gold, although that's another scam. But if you have, like, say, coins, you can't lose the coins unless they actually travel somewhere else, and then you go, oh, well, that coin is in now somebody else's pocket.
Yeah.
But where did these billions go? Partly to what he and his family looted. But anyway, let's get on to this. I mean, he had some help with this. Pardon me. And federal authorities are preparing to take action in a criminal investigation of J.P. Morgan Chase, suspecting that the bank turned a blind eye to Bernard Madoff's Ponzi scheme. Now, this guy, think of his name, Madoff. Made off. If somebody said, here, we're going to give your money to someone named Madoff, I'm going to go, what? Like, what's his name?
Ultimate irony, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly. So these banks were all involved in it as well. The Madoff case, coming on the heels of this tentative $13 billion settlement over J.P. Morgan's mortgage practices, poses another major threat to the reputation of the nation's largest bank. Now, here's what I'm putting all together. With Kwame Kilpatrick getting 28 years, this mass murderer in Norway, Anders Breivik, getting 21 years, mm-hmm. and the idea that people think that Kwame Kilpatrick deserves what he got because of the damage he did to the city, these banksters sunk our economy. The reason that our communities are suffering these cutbacks, the reason that Detroit and other cities, one of which I will talk about in a little while, are suffering what they are is because of these scams of these financiers, these bankers, these investment brokers, and all of the rest of these people. So let's see. Are the bloodhounds on them? Let's go to the documents here. And they're after J.P. Morgan. They've already agreed to a $13 billion settlement because of their mortgage practices. Reflecting the magnitude of the investigation, this is from the New York Times Deal Book. Prosecutors and J.P. Morgan have held preliminary discussions about a so-called deferred prosecution agreement. Yeah.
Fancy. What does it mean?
I'll tell you what. Anybody there committed a federal crime, or can you imagine a federal crime, say, hey, come on, prosecutor, let's talk about this. Can I get a deferred prosecution agreement? Put this off? Such an agreement would suspend criminal charges against J.P. Morgan in exchange for a fine, certain other concessions, and acknowledgement that the bank will face charges if it fails to behave in the future.
I mean, please.
Yeah. Now, there's a missing referent here. In other words, there's somebody missing in the picture, and it's somebody. J.P. Morgan was somebody, but about 120 or 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's people sitting atop of this firm and at different levels of criminality that nothing is happening to. The common criminals, certainly the people that are doing little ripoffs in the street, who are reviled with an intensity that doesn't match what's aimed at these rich cats.
Yeah.
Fat cats.
I don't know where the disconnect is with the American people. But why aren't they more mad about this, like you're saying?
It's almost, though, you know, I can kind of see it.
I think they're paying attention.
Like a carjacker, which makes the top of the news. This is stuck way in the back in, the business section of the New York Times. You know, it doesn't even make the Detroit News or Free Press. A carjacker, it's palpable. You can almost feel that this happening to you. Everyone here feels like they could be a victim of a carjack, right?
Sure.
Although they probably got an equal chance to be struck by lightning, even though it does happen, and I think they're up. I think carjackings are up.
Well, as a matter of fact, my boyfriend, did I tell you that he got carjacked?
Oh, I thought you were going to say he carjacked
someone. No. Oh, God. That was three boyfriends ago.
Yeah,
just
okay.
Kidding. No, he was carjacked and, at gunpoint, stole his car. They found it crashed into a tree. And pretty scary.
What's happening? Oh, you know, that always happens. These people carjack and they run into a canal. I mean,
yeah,
why?
Yeah. His,
why are people that want to steal cars, why can't they stay on the road?
I got to say, it's a pretty hot car, too, so it's really sad.
Well,
but he's alive. That's what matters.
So that's palpable, and although you would think city cutbacks, city bankruptcies, unemployment, working at a job that's half the pay as you had previously would be palpable also. And at some level, I'm sure it is. But there is not the outrage. You think that people would be out in the streets with pitchforks and torches in front of J.P. Morgan and the rest of these characters that sunk our economy.
I mean, there has been there have been some protests. There have been some, but not enough. The outrage really is it's just not enough.
So here's what they're doing with J.P. Morgan, that they are going to fine them for cooperating with this Bernard Madoff. And J.P. Morgan has repeatedly said that, quote, all personnel acted in good faith in the Madoff manner. And they may have to, you ready for this? They're really going to slam
them. What?
They may have to hire an independent monitor.
Oh, gosh. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Don't do anything fair, you know.
The government, the people added that were giving this information, has not ruled out a harsher punishment for J.P. Morgan's Chase's national banking subsidiary. Prosecutors could demand that the unit plead guilty to a criminal violation of the Bank Secrecy Act, a federal law requiring financial institutions to report suspicious activity. They're going to demand that the unit, I got their unit.
What does that mean?
It means that nobody's going to get prosecuted, that the unit is going to get prosecuted. So they'll have to pay a fine.
And that's it.
And Jamie Dimon.
And they have the money, so here you go. Here's the money. Go away.
Let's see if there's more in this. All right. No, there's not in this one. But also, how about this? And by the way, when you read the New York Times section, if you're, some of you, I know, aren't going to be flying, but if you're in an airport or if you're somewhere near a New York Times or you see one laying around somewhere, forget the front page and the sports and actually the sports. It's my favorite section because it actually has the business section and the sports section right together.
Yeah.
So grab that and grab the business section and take a look at it. It's like the crime blotter.
The white-collar crime blotter.
Yeah, right. The Bank of America, one of the nation's largest banks, was found liable on Wednesday of having sold defective mortgages, a jury decision that will be seen as a victory for the government in its aggressive effort to hold banks accountable for their role in the housing crisis. Now, can you see these big, huge buildings, you know, going into an office? No people, big buildings, and, you know, stuff like that. These were people that conspired to fleece investors for their profit and wound up sinking our economy. This is Reaganomics, you know, no regulation and what have you, the free market and all of that. Let's see, during the trial, federal prosecutors accused Rebecca Maroney, a top manager Countrywide at the time. This was, I'm sorry, Bank of America's Countrywide Financial Unit.
Countrywide, I haven't heard that one for a while.
Top manager of having opted for quantity over quality in its mortgage writing program, which resulted in the bank churning out to unqualified buyers housing loans that were destined to fail. Then, of course, they sold them off to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and we all wind up paying for it, and it was just this spiral downward. The program linked bonuses to how fast bankers could originate loans, and as a result, the credit quality of the borrower was given short shrift. In other words, you know, don't worry about it. Remember that stuff? We used to run ads for it. You know, interest-only loans and all this, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, no credit. Don't worry about your past credit.
Well, those things are still all over the place. You know that. You watch any daytime television, and they're targeting people who they believe are not working or have some type of, you know, had a disability or something like that. They're all over the place, Peter.
Wow. Prosecutors have asked that the Bank of America pay a fine of $848 million. You know what? You know where they're going to get the $848 million?
You and me.
No.
Oh.
The CEO is going to come in and say, how much is it? $848 million. He's going to say, here's a billion. Keep the change. You know, I have this big wad of Chases in his pocket. You get that? Chases?
No.
Isn't Chase on, or, yeah, Salmon B. Chase or somebody like that, on the $10,000 bill?
How would I know that?
I don't know. How do I know this?
How do you know that?
I don't know.
I know you don't have one in your pocket right now.
No, I would, I don't know. Wouldn't that be weird to actually have
it? You give it away to some kind of really cool cause, like Sea Shepherd or something, if you had that kind of money.
No, I wouldn't. Take a trip to Italy.
You liar. You could do both.
But $10,000?
Yeah.
That's a pittance to these guys.
Kind of a frugal guy.
Well, yeah, but I got to say, I might, but you, I would tithe. I would tithe, rather. Tithe 10%.
Okay.
So I'll give us $1,000 to Earth First or Sea Shepherds or something
yeah.
like that. Yeah. All right, we are talking the talk, but we'd like to get you folks in on it as well. So come on back, and we'll talk. What do you want? What should we? Oh, you know what I want to talk about? I forgot about this.
What's that?
You are not going to believe this, because Jalene and I are not big fans of religion. We're not religious, and we're not even believers. But at 1 a.m., which is an hour and 10 minutes, I'm going to be interviewing a Catholic priest.
Well, good.
Well, actually,
because I you know some cool Catholic priests. I mean, you have.
He got fired.
Well,
and not in the sex scandals.
Oh, I know, Roy Bourgeois. Well, let's talk about it. When
well,
we come
yeah,
back.
Yeah. Check this out.
Make your opinion heard. Call us at our new number 248-544-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night call.
In case you haven't heard, Esurance is built to save you money on car insurance. You know, cash, or clams, or greenbacks, sawbucks, simoleons, smack, chips, or scratch. Esurance. Now backed by Allstate. Click or call.
Not available in Allstate. Savings may vary. Allstate products are not available through Esurance.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes, or if the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
My dad is my hero. He goes into burning buildings. He finds people inside who need to be saved. He helps them get out, even when he can't breathe or see or is a little scared. My dad is a firefighter, but the best thing he can do is come home.
The U.S. Fire Administration reminds you to protect yourself and firefighters. Have smoke alarms on every level and near sleeping areas. Test them monthly. Change batteries as instructed. Install sprinklers. Do your part to get out before firefighters have to come in. The fact is, most fire deaths occur in homes with no working smoke alarms. The good news is, that's a fact we can change. Smoke alarms save lives. Find out more at usfa.dhs.gov.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Wait, what?
Everything that rocks.
Peter and Jalene, you're listening to Night Call, the Riz award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
Thank you very much, and welcome back. This is our second hour. I'd like you to join us at 248-544-WRIF, which is
248-544-9743. And that the thing is, you know, we just sit here and assume people are hanging on our every word. And so there are people out there who don't realize we have a new phone number and okay. perhaps are trying to call the old one. So just Write it down, 248-544-WRIF.
And also, we keep changing back and forth our email address. It is, again, calltalkyes@yahoo.com.
We're done changing that.
If you go,
you're done changing
hey,
that.
Hey, when I say our Facebook page, do I have to say facebook.com/nightcall? Or is that like those people that, you know, you see those older people on television and they say, what's the website? And they go, www.
I don't think you really need to. They can just search Night Call.
Search Night Call.
Yeah.
Or
you can say that. Either way.
Facebook.com/Night Call gets you right there. Also, my website's got a lot of interesting stuff on it. Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And I'm not bragging. I just copy and paste.
You have good. You do. And there's.
What?
There's
I do brag?
No. You do have good things on that website. And the Russell Brand. Tell me
Thank
about
you.
The Russell Brand.
Does everybody know who Russell Brand
yeah,
is?
Yeah, the comedy actor. I mean, in this audience, for sure, I think people know.
Well, if you go
British
to either my hilarious. Website or, I mean, I don't know, maybe we can play a little bit. But he's talking to this BBC newsman, and he's saying why he doesn't vote. And he's calling for revolution. And it's like money. I don't know if everybody will get this allusion, but it's like Monty Python meets Emma Goldman.
People are not going to get that at
all.
All
right, Google Emma Goldman. She was called the most dangerous woman in America. She was an anarchist that lived from, from the 1860s to 1930, right?
She was a way cool
1940.
Lady.
1940.
And our friend has some of her stuff, right?
Oh, yeah. Right. I'm sorry.
Her suitcase.
Yeah. I was reading I thought you were going to talk. I was reading our Facebook page. Actor and comedian Russell Brand is calling for a political and philosophical revolution in his guest editorship of the New Statesman magazine and explain what he wants to see in a passionately argued interview.
You know, he doesn't curse in that, does he?
I don't think so.
Like, well, let's not play it right now because we have some phone calls and I think we should take them. But let's play a little bit of it maybe in the next half hour.
You know what, though? It's like listening to Monty Python. It's hard to understand.
We'll try it. We'll try.
All right. Anyway, we're talking about the priest, Roy Bourgeois, who founded the School of the Americas Watch, School of the Americas in Columbus, Georgia, at Fort Benning. And it trains soldiers from Latin America and has done so for about 60 or 70 years. And these guys go back and murder their own people because why is the United States even, why are they spending
our
money?
Why are we involved?
Training soldiers from other countries because all they've ever done is repress their own people.
It's just not enough to have that outrageous defense budget that we have here. So we got to take it elsewhere, too.
Yeah. And who was, usually he's called Father Roy. Father Roy was a priest for 40 years. He got a Purple Heart in Vietnam. And he was in Latin America. He got kicked out of Latin America by the dictatorship there. But he continually... called for the ordination of women, for women to be priests, and right from the Vatican. They said, Roy, you are out of here.
And we call him our friend.
Citizen Roy now, yeah. Also, Dana Frank with a great story about a downtown Detroit Woolworths sit-in during the Great Depression, during 1937. So it's history, but it's a great little story. That's at 1 o'clock. All right, let's go. We'll tell you about the priest that we're not so fond of when we go to them. All right, let's go to Ron. Ron is, let's see here. Ron is in Shelby Township. I'm wondering, let me see here. Ron, are you with me?
Yes, Peter, Jolene.
Hi.
Hi, Ron.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Doing great.
I just want to finish making a comment that I was going to, I was on last week, and for some reason I was cut off, and I called back, and I was told that I could only call in once a night.
Right.
I just want to, I have a very interesting quote for everybody. You know, all this stuff that's going on in the country and everything is blah, 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 whatever. You know, all this stuff, you know, lies and deception and whatever, you know, all this stuff has to do with it being in the
out with it, man.
this all has to do with being planned since the Kennedy years.
Here.
Okay.
Wait! I missed it. It has
Kennedy
to do with what?
Years.
The Kennedy years.
I have a very interesting quote. This all goes back into planning since the Kennedy years, because in a memo, former CIA director William Colby.
Yeah.
Okay, you've
they
heard
named,
him?
Sure, they named cheese after him.
Yeah, William Colby, former CIA director. some guy back a while ago bought an old IBM copy machine, okay? A government surplus, basically scrap weight. And in this copy machine was jammed a letter from William Colby to, I guess, President Kennedy. And part of that letter, there's an excerpt that says he's telling Kennedy, we will have won. This is a quote. I quote him. We will have won when the American people believe everything that is false. Now, doesn't that blow your mind?
Well, it would sort of blow my mind if there was any accuracy or truth to it, but I doubt it. And here's what I'm going to do. You are going to experience the same thing right now that you did last week. We will look that up, and I'm sure it's not true, Ron. So I don't know if that makes there's a lot to be upset about. I don't think that's one of them.
Well,
Jalene, is your computer working?
No, and I think there is a deeper point that he was trying to make, though, Peter. I think he's trying to say that rings true in politics and today, that these politicians want us to just follow them aimlessly and believe all of their lies and all the misinformation.
Well, absolutely.
That's what he's trying to say.
Well, then he should have said that. I mean, in other words, though, to say that the director of the CIA said, we will have won. Who's the we here, anyway? Who's he talking about? Two of them?
I think he was talking about we, the people who want war. Don't you think?
No. I don't think the quote is accurate.
Well,
I don't even think...
I agree with that, but
yeah.
I'm just trying to get to what he
was trying
to get to.
Listen, there's enough awful things going on. Is that we don't have to have fake quotes, what I'm saying. But listen, folks, why don't we... Everything is kind of a technological mess around here. Do you ever hear that on any other station or talk show? But you know what? Somebody
Peter,
do some work.
We have one of the most state-of-the-art studios in the country.
Oh, no, part
do you
of
realize
it,
that?
No, part of it is, we do. Part of it is, best phones. Part of it is...
My laptop doesn't work.
Yeah, I know. And part of it is our phone, internally, nothing to do with the station or the technology or anything. That's what I meant by that. But I'm just asking, will some listener go to Google and just put in, for instance, like, letter Colby Kennedy, something like that, right? Or, something along those lines. All right, while we're getting some more calls, whether you're looking that up for me, you're on the research staff of Night Call. Thank you for joining us. As that. Pope Francis suspends the Bishop of Bling.
Yeah, this was something else, let me tell you.
Pope Francis today suspended the free-spending German bishop, Franz Peter Tebartz von Elst, known derisively as Bishop Deluxe or the Bishop of Bling, and ordered him
out of the diocese
of Limburg. That stinks.
What?
Limburg is a cheese, which is...
Limburger!
Well, that's somebody who lives
from
in Limburg.
Limburg.
Yeah.
Oh,
have you ever had Limburg cheese?
Oh, hell no.
Or smell it? I don't even want to say what it smells
like.
Yeah, it's good. Actually, I like it. That and Bear Queso.
You like
another cheese, yeah.
You like Limburger?
Yeah.
You also like sardines. You like the weirdest stuff. Ugh.
Everybody likes sardines, don't they? You don't have...
You're a vegetarian.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Well, not if I eat sardines.
You're a pescatarian.
On rye, you have sardines, hard-boiled eggs, onion, and mayonnaise. You've got the eating habits of a 12-year-old.
And I'm a chef. But you know what? I'll go for the anchovies, but they got to be kind of melted in
oil or something. Yeah.
Butter. No, they need to dissolve.
Right.
They
do that in olive oil.
But we digress.
Yeah, we do.
Bishop
From the
of
Bishop
Bling.
Of Bling. The Vatican, not only did they kick out Father Roy Bourgeois for calling for the ordination of women, they also kicked out German Bishop Teberts von Elst for being the Bishop of Bling. Final decision on the big spending priest will be determined only after the German Bishop Conference has finished a detailed report on the cost of construction, remodeling of the bishop's official residence. Are you ready for this? The Pope was told last week that the final cost may be $55 million for this priest's residence. That's stunning, isn't it?
You know, yeah. We know that the Vatican is huge business.
They're
one of the most wealthy corporations in the world.
You know,
the
Pope won't even live in the papal mansion. He's all about
frugal, if there is any frugality in the Vatican.
$13 million over the already substantial price tag. The Bishop Teberts von Elst met with Pope Francis in a 20-minute closed-door meeting last Monday. The German media reports that after the discussion, the bishop was upbeat, calling it an encouraging conversation.
Oh, please. And you know what? He's probably got, like, mistresses and, you know.
But he's not been seen in public since the meeting. The bishop continues to insist that the costs were part of the need for his historical preservation of the 10 buildings on the property, including his $20,000 bathtub.
See?
Yeah.
You think he's in that bathtub alone? I think
not. And I thought I had a lot of cover to kind of be anti-religious because we're going to have Father Roy Bourgeois on at 1 o'clock. But let me get some of these calls on here. Let's see. Here is, this is interesting. Here's Kevin and Wayne. Kevin, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey. Thanks. Yeah, I was just thinking that, I mean, it's time for the, I mean, like, what's his name? Russell Brand was saying, you know, revolution. I think it really is time in this country for a revolution. And I'd hate to see a violent revolution, but in order to prevent a violent revolution, I mean, people have to start thinking and take action now. I mean, like, it's ridiculous how much is going on with the government. I mean, Obama almost started World War III.
When?
Well, with the whole Syria thing.
Well, that's, I fortunately backed off. You know why he backed off? Because of popular opposition. I was just reading something about...
Right, but, I mean, the thing is, I mean, it took 91% of the population being against it, and it took soldiers holding signs on video saying that they will not fight in Syria on the side of Al-Qaeda.
Well, think about this, though. The vast majority of the world's people were against George Bush
going into Iraq
on this war based totally on lies that they knew were lies, and they still went ahead.
Right? I mean, the problem is that Obama is so much of a continuation of Bush. I mean, so much is the same thing.
Well, the U.S. presidency is the imperial presidency, and in that regard, you're absolutely right. They're wedded to the military-industrial complex. They're wedded to Wall Street, without a doubt. What makes the Democrats any better than the Republicans? I'd say yeah, only because there's certainly the screwball level hovers around zero with the Democrats, and it's almost complete with the Republicans. And these people really are hostile towards the poor, towards working people, towards the middle class.
Women,
they're in the direct pay of the billionaires. I mean, the policies that govern the United States are the policies of Wall Street, without a doubt. There is at least the party in its rhetoric, the Democratic Party, says it wants to defend Medicare and Social Security, stuff like that, that want health care for everyone. Whether they actually can live up to that is another thing. But, you know, we, in many ways, and maybe we could come to an agreement on this, that we just got to, in some ways, ignore these parties and act as our own on the people. We play Power to the People by John Lennon at the beginning of this show, and that's really where it lays. I mean, if you think about the manner in which when the people act, suddenly the Let me give you an idea. The Republicans, who are always, you know, who, that's where all the racists go, and they're hostile towards people of color. Well, suddenly, when they realize they're not getting any of the Hispanic vote, what are they doing? Oh, they're all for immigration reform and what have you. So we can make these people hop, too, if we do something, right?
I mean, to a certain extent. I mean, nothing slowing down the military-industrial complex. I mean, Obama did not slow down.
No, not at all.
He
expanded it.
I mean, they expanded it.
No, wait a minute. He is ending these wars, without a doubt.
But he's keeping the drones going. That's disturbing.
I mean, I don't really see him ending the wars with him attacking Libya and starting tensions with shit. Well, I mean...
Well, that's gone. He's not actually. That worked out for the better. Although I'll tell you, a lot of these countries have a vested interest in that Syrian war going on and on.
And we're not Obama sympathizers, by the way.
No, but if I would say that the majority of failings of Obama rest in the hands of the people that support him, because I keep going back to this, his book called The Audacity of Hope. We just hope that Obama's going to do the right thing. Well, he's a politician, and politicians get moved around by a lot of historic forces, a lot of things that have come before him. And much of what's come before him, as you indicated correctly, was the Bush administration and functioning in a particular way. You know, I was listening to this newscast, and they said that the United States' main enemy in the Middle East is Syria and Iran. Everybody probably said, yeah, that's right. That's true. But then I posed the question, I may have done it on this show, I said, who's the major enemy of China in the Middle East? Well, guess what? They don't have any. And who's the major enemies of Russia in the Middle East? Guess what? They don't have any. And they don't have any because they're not trying to prop up governments, train troops, send billions of dollars to dictatorships, intervening militarily, bombing. You know, we say, well, man, those people in Iran are really crazy, right? We're fighting two wars on their borders, one on Afghanistan, it's on their border, and the other one on Iraq. I mean,
that's a little touch and go there, right?
I mean, it would be like if China was fighting a war against Mexico and a war against Canada, if you can imagine that. And they were doing it as part of their North American command, the Chinese North American command. So the problem is that, well, the problem is, and the solution lies in extracting ourselves from these entanglements that George Washington talked about that we don't need and that make things worse. That's when we get back to the military industrial complex. Everything is this Mobius strip without an end. It's just all no edge, one-sided. It plays back on itself. So, you know, we have these enemies, so then we have to bomb, these countries, which, it's not even clear that there's that doesn't violate international law, like everywhere from Yemen to Pakistan. More and more people hate us, and more people want to do damage to us. And then that means we got to do more and more military expenditures, which then we have to intervene in more and more, so this just goes on and on. All right. Thank you very much, Kevin. I appreciate your call.
The question is, how do we revolutionize without violence?
Yeah. Well,
how do we do it?
You know, there have been, in fact, the nonviolent revolutions have a higher degree of success than the violent ones.
Well, and the thing is, in regard to this phone call, people are mad. People are so PO'd in this country, but they're just talking about it. You know, there's a whole lot of talk going on.
And what are they going to do? I mean, what it occurs to me, say, well, Obama, he didn't do everything right. The healthcare system's new healthcare system didn't work well. We didn't get our jobs back. So I'm going to vote for the Republican. I'm going to vote for Ted Cruz for president or some of these other creatures from the Black Lagoon.
That's a nightmare. Yeah.
Hey, by the way, remember that quote about... what did he say? That it was from the head of the CIA, Colby, to President Kennedy. We will have won when everything that is true, everything that is false is seen by true from people.
Yeah.
Ron called in and says the quote was from the book of William Cooper called Behold the Pale Horse.
Oh, so it's from a book.
Fictional book, yeah.
Okay.
A little more information on that. All right, you know what I want to do? I want to, like I said, I got my cover. We're going to be interviewing a priest in 45 minutes, a guy that is devoted to the Catholic Church. I said to him, given the sexual scandals, the financial improprieties, the fact that they kicked your butt out. I didn't say that quite like that.
Not to Father Roy.
He wouldn't care. I mean, this guy was a rough, tough.
I love him.
Yeah. Vietnam vet. The guy's like 75 or something like that. So I can do this. And this was in the newspaper Free Thought Today. It's the publication of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. And a lot of people claim that this is a Christian nation. It was based on Christian values. And
as far as the government goes.
The government goes, yeah. So here is an article in which it says the Constitution mentions religion, but only to specify limitations on its ability to influence America. There's no mention. It's a totally secular document. And this is in an era where everybody was religious. Many of the founding fathers had no religion, or what they called deists. They thought there was a big God that kind of pushed the universe into being, and then it was all up to us. In particular, says the article, it requires that there is no religious test for public office, and that, well, that is so important. No religious test for office, and it says in the Constitution, ever.
Yeah, and what was that state recently that...
A number of states say that you must have...
You must be a person of faith or something like that to run for office.
This is unique in the world, that particularly at that time, and may still be, who knows, that the foundation document says that that you cannot require a religious test for public office. All right. And then Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or, of course, prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The Constitution's rejection of religious tests for public office was unique for its time, both in America and worldwide. In fact, the Constitution's silence concerning Christianity has repeatedly inspired religious groups to propose amending it. They want to insert that. In both 1864 and 1946, evangelical Christian groups tried but failed to get references to God and Jesus Christ inserted into the Constitution and were blown out. So you can't do it. Some of this, by the way, is not, but the articles. The article didn't say it was blown out.
I hear you. Yeah. Your words. Isn't it amazing, though, even though it says this in this document, that during election times, there's so much focus on the religion of who's these folks who are running.
Yeah.
You know?
It's nauseating.
I try to get anyone other than a Christian in office, you know, as president. I'd like to see it. I mean, I'm just saying it wouldn't happen.
Yeah. The article continues in Free Thought Today. The purpose of the Constitution is explicitly stated in its preamble: to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, get this one, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty. Nowhere does it mention Christianity or God. Additionally, some of the governing principles found in the documents conflict with Christian teachings. The Constitution in Article 6 lists itself, along with treaties and federal statutes, as the supreme law of the land. This claim contradicts the Christian teaching that either God or God's word is the ultimate authority. The Declaration of Independence asserts that government derives its power not from God, but from, quote, the consent of the governed. The 13th Amendment of the Constitution bans slavery, but you folks that read the Bible know that the Bible does not, in Exodus and Leviticus and Luke, and there's something called Colossians. I never heard of that one.
I've even heard of that one.
No, I don't look at the book too much. The biblical acceptance of slavery contradicts the Declaration's assertion that all humans have the unalienable right to liberty. That was, of course, violated by the Southern states. That was one of the fundamental reasons that we have the problems that we do, the Southern states and their slavery. Then also it says the First Amendment holds that Congress cannot enact laws prohibiting religious exercise or freedom of speech, which conflicts with the Ten Commandments, because, you know, they say the one religion. Freedom of religious practice contradicts the commandments to only worship the God of the Bible, to not make or to worship idols, and to not work on the Sabbath. In other words, one is free to worship idols if they prefer.
Okay.
But you cannot do it under the terms of the Ten Commandments, right?
What? I'm so confused now.
The first command, what does it say? Thou shall have no other gods before the...
I just know that you're not supposed to do your neighbor's wife or something like
that. Yeah, well, that's in there. That's in there. Most of them, the ones that are in there are just common sense, you know. Don't kill people, don't steal, don't cover.
What if the neighbor's husband says, go ahead?
Jesus. You live in a weird neighborhood, I gotta tell you. No, dude, but,
you're just jealous.
Yes. But in other words, it says, the commandment says you only worship the God of the Bible and you cannot make or worship idols. But if one wants to, the Constitution gives one the right to do it.
Okay.
Okay. All right. A freedom of speech contradicts the commandment to not take the Lord's name in vain.
Okay.
All right. So that's just all these contradictions.
Yeah.
Anybody have a comment on that? Our number is 248-544-WRIF. Let's see.
New phone number, by the way.
Well, people are starting to do this. Yeah. Kevin says we can start by voting for anyone other than the Democrats or Republicans. The Democans or the Republicrats. Sorry, he says. Well, you know, it doesn't work. I mean, everybody is afraid. Like, say you had some right-wing party. And there's some right-wing parties out there.
The baggers, for example.
Yeah, well, they usually do. They wind up being in the Republican Party, but I can't remember the names of, like, Liberty Party or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
So there are these far-right wingers, and they say the Republicans are not true conservatives or they're not right-wing enough, right? Mm-hmm. But then the people that would vote for them, that agree with them, don't do it because they're afraid a Democrat will get in. So now on the left, they'll have something like the Green Party.
Yeah.
If you read the Green Party, platform, I'm willing to bet if you didn't say it was in the Green Party and it was a left party and all that, that probably 75% of the American people would say, yeah, I go for that. Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
But then people say, if you vote for the Green Party,
then you're taking away from
the Dems.
You're getting the Republicans
and
in.
You're going to get the teabaggers in.
It's just another one of those vicious circles. Another one.
It's political blackmail.
And how do we grow that Green Party? How do you grow that third party? It's going to take forever.
Could be.
Sadly.
Could be. You know what I think? I think that it's going to happen like it's happened in some of those, what do they call them, like purple revolutions and all that. Remember, they just all of a sudden there'll be 20 million people in the street. You know, and that's what's happening. I mean, there's been so many things you would have thought everybody would have flooded the streets and say, no, I know this can't happen. We know that mass action like this works, but
yeah,
isn't happening.
There's action. There's just not enough.
All right, let's do this. Here is, I'm wrong button. Here is Scott in Westland. Hi, Scott. You're on the air. I think you may need to be careful about not talking about one of our sponsors, for instance. Does that hurt your comment?
Am I here? Am I on?
You're on, dude. Did you hear what I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Okay, great. Okay.
Scott, did you hear what I just said? I had a little proviso there. No?
A sponsor, okay.
Yeah, I don't want you talking about a sponsor.
You don't want me to.
I know, I don't.
All right. The radio station.
Yeah, we're gonna take this up another day, but call back with.
Send an email.
Yeah, send an email. All right.
We have some open lines, so 248-544-9743.
One of the things that's happening in Detroit is with this bankruptcy thing. And boy, you know, the other day there was like 1,000 people surrounding.
See, right there, Peter, there's an example of there are protests going on. But I'm sorry to interrupt that.
That's all right.
Right in the middle of a sentence.
People that were saying, hey, look, you can't pay off the banksters that Detroit owes money to and take it away from the pensioners. And there's sort of the made out, you know, the employees on pensions are these greedy people. They're making like 19 grand a year. You know, people that are devoted their life to city services, but whatever. One of the things that people that keep saying is that Detroit has $18 billion in pension and health care debt, right?
Okay.
Guess what the city of Chicago has?
What?
$20 billion.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, the problem is, though, of course, they maintain a tax base, and what's happened is that's all eroded. Industry left when it began, leaving 50 years ago or so, and now it's kind of down to not much. A friend of mine who has connections, which in fact I had breakfast with this morning, has friends in an area, a residential area around Wayne State University.
Okay.
In a neighborhood, and they said nobody pays property tax at all. Zero.
For real?
Yeah.
I mean, aren't they kind of going after these people?
Well, you know, the banks in a lot of ways don't want them back. The city, what are they going to do? The city wind up with them on their hands. So, but, you know, they did that for a while with parking tickets. You could park in Detroit, and you would not get a you know, if you got a parking ticket, they had no for a while.
They've changed that, by the way.
Yeah.
I owe one right now.
Yeah.
I got to get on that tomorrow. Thanks for reminding me.
How much?
Well, it was a $20 ticket.
And now
it's $45.
That's just a meter, probably?
Mm-hmm.
Whew. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're going up. Like, I just went to this.
I just couldn't get out of bed to go put another quarter in. Yeah, just keep moving along.
You weren't at home. There are no parking meters on your residential street. Should we continue this line of conversation? No. Okay.
But it's always good to remain somewhat of a mystery.
Yeah, this doesn't seem like much of a mystery.
Let's be real. I'm transparent. Go
yes,
ahead.
Right. Whoa. My little program here just went kind of nuts on me, but it's okay. It's back.
Are we okay? Okay.
Yeah. So one of the things that's happening, you know, the defenders of the rich among the working class, you know, the people that that can't deal with being critical
yes.
of the class above them.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That they're just this dutiful peon.
Little soldiers.
Yeah. And they say, you know, a poor man never gave another man a job. It's rich people that give us the
yes,
job.
Yes, we hear that a lot.
Well, you know what? I mean, to some extent, that's coming true in Detroit because you have this billionaire takeover of Detroit with Dan Gilbert buying up these, what does he own now? Like 2 million square feet of property downtown. There's this, and I don't have this in front of me, this firm that that has gotten a go-ahead to buy up all these parcels of land where they're going to print or plant
like urban
gardens. I mean,
green spaces?
Huge gardens.
Really?
And put in thousands of trees.
Wonderful.
And there was a third example. Oh, wait a minute. I just saw it's this family. It was these two brothers or something. And what are they bringing to Detroit? So, who knows?
Were they the ones in the restaurant business that started Slow's Barbecue?
No. These people had a lot more money than that. So we are going to have the lords of the land providing what we need.
What other choices do we have, Peter?
Well, that's what I mean.
Like, honestly, you know, I mean, but still, that mentality is no mentality to have. This is a unique situation, in my opinion, the city
sure.
of Detroit. And the pride of people like Dan Gilbert, who cares
yeah.
about this city, you know, it's unique.
You know, I was at Thursday through Saturday, I was at something called the North American Labor History Conference.
Yeah. Why do you do that?
I know. That's what people
it's
think.
Important, though.
How many people would go to a North American Labor History Conference?
I didn't even know it was going on. I am so off the radar.
It was extraordinarily interesting. Old buddy, who you know, Frank Joyce, who for a long time was the public relations director for the
UAW?
Yeah. To which he hired us.
He did hire us.
He did hire us for the UAW network 13 years ago now.
My gosh, Peter.
But he was talking, it was sort of a long, they present these, people talk for like 15 minutes, and they're academics.
Like panels.
Yeah, but they're actually interesting. And you know, just like I interview a lot of profs, and they're used to explaining complex situations and concepts to freshmen, they're pretty clear. And there were a lot of union people there, too, just rank and file people, you know, not college students or anything.
Yeah.
And so Frank Joyce was saying that people make, and this is the key, people make a lot of the fact, and rightly they should, that all of the cities that have been taken over by the emergency manager are African-American cities, are predominantly African-American.
Right.
And Frank Joyce said the question that no one ever asks is, why are there predominantly African-American cities?
That's a good question.
Yeah. I'm going to get him on the show and answer.
Oh, good.
We are going to take a break, and I'm going to come back. And what's the most you ever paid for a shot of booze?
Do you want it? Really?
Yeah.
Like almost $60.
Well, you're not going to be shocked by this next story. I thought I had something here. I want to hear yours, though. All right. We'll be right back, and maybe you can call in.
Actually, someone bought it for me.
I know.
Would never do that.
Yeah. Was there a parking meter out front?
I think there was.
All right. We'll be right back.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Riff. Peter and Jalene will return with more of your calls in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
These days, when I'm in a relationship, I feel like I'm alone.
Like there's no one behind the mask. No voice on the other end of the line. Are you looking for a car insurance policy totally devoted to you? At GEICO.com, you'll find a sympathetic ear, a shoulder to cry on, butterfly kisses, and easy ways to pay your bill and manage your policy. We're waiting with bated breath to help you save money and talk about your feelings. GEICO. 15 minutes could save you hundreds on car insurance.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or if the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
Jeez, Q. It's hot as in here. What's going on?
Oh, it's only 91 degrees.
Where? In the refrigerator?
Ouch. The countertop is so hot you can fry eggs on it. And bacon and home fries. Are you on that sweat diet? No.
I'm melting my life away.
Hey, by not running my air conditioner, I'm saving energy and helping the environment.
Uh-huh. There's an easier way to help the environment. Go green. Go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment, and you don't have to sweat it, if you know what I mean. So you got any eggs?
No.
How about shrimp? We can fry shrimp. Do you have any shrimp?
No. I have anchovies.
Mm-mm, no.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
101 WRIF. Oh!
Learn all my lessons before now. Born to be down.
HD1 Detroit. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Here are Peter and Julie.
All right, it's our final segment, so get in on it. 248-544-WRIF, which is...
248-544-9743. It feels so weird after how many years have I been on this show?
Yeah.
1998 I started. All those years having a different phone number is just so weird.
Not to me, because I never could memorize it.
That's true.
I read it every time I... Now, Ron called in a little while ago and told us about this quote, which I said on the face of it seemed preposterous. Now, I'm looking at this site called Infinite Unknown, and it has these quotes, which is the one that Ron said. But because I'm looking at it, doesn't mean it's true, but it's exactly what he said. It's not Colby at all. It's William Casey. CIA,
that name I remember.
Now, Casey.
Colby, I wasn't quite sure who the heck he was talking about.
Actually, there was a documentary done about William Colby by his son. I interviewed him a little while ago. But anyway, William Casey, CIA director from his first staff meeting, says, "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American people believes is false." You know, the construction of the sentence is actually nuts. "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false."
No, that makes
sense. Oh, I see what they
mean. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm sorry. You're right. You know what? Here it is in red and white. It's in red type. I just because it's there doesn't mean it's there. I don't believe it. So one thing, it wasn't Colby. It was Casey. And here, from William Colby, "The CIA owns everyone of any significance in the major media." Well, it could be, particularly back then when Colby was the CIA director. And there's a lot of quotes here I just think are suspicious. I'll check this out during the week.
Well, why is it that site called Infinite Unknown?
Because that's what they call it.
What does that mean? Is it like it's not? Is it the opposite of Snopes or what?
I don't know. Oh, that's a good idea. I forgot about Snopes.
I've never heard of it.
Looked it up on Snopes.
Never heard of that one.
Yeah. Okay. "I will splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it into the winds." This is attributed to John F. Kennedy. I think that's part of the conspiracy about Kennedy's assassination, that he was going to do that, and that's why they took him out. But who knows? Pardon me. Let's not thrash around.
I don't think anyone's ever going to be able to answer that one.
All right. So there's a lot of corporate crimes, a lot of city corruption and all that. But here is the crime of the century. Kentucky bourbon, a drink that used to be like for the common man, usually, straight bourbon, like a Chevrolet. High-end bar chefs now and foodies everywhere have become a buzz since 65 cases of Pappy Van Winkle, one of the nation's most expensive and sought-after bourbons, has disappeared from a warehouse. It was stolen. They do small batches of Pappy Van Winkle to bars and retailers each autumn, and they're tracked by connoisseurs who snatch it up as soon as it hits the shelf. And here's the deal. A two-ounce shot. Oh, 2 ounces? Wow.
Two ounces is a shot, basically, isn't it?
Oh, maybe.
I think that's
was an ounce.
An average shot.
Oh, good. We call it a good pour.
Okay.
Right. Of 20-year-old Pappy costs $65, and the even rarer 23-year-old is $75. So, but you had an expensive...
I had this was many, many years ago, and it was, a situation where there was a host paying, it was quite wealthy, paying for everyone's dinner, and he's like, "Everyone will have a cognac. Everyone will have one." And I'm like, my God, did I say $59 for one little, snifter or whatever?
Yeah.
And, I did. And, it felt expensive going down my throat.
Well, I can, usually you say you're going to blot out the names, protect, the innocent, but, not so here. But she's shaking her head.
Leave it alone.
No, I'm going to do it. There was a WRIF party, and we used to do these big trade-outs with...
Oh, this is a totally separate situation here.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. So,
There was no segue there.
Oh, so we were, the station was paying for this dinner by what they call trade out. So we would
barter.
Average,
yeah, like a barter,
a barter deal. And what's the name of that real fancy restaurant on the corner of Woodward and Canfield? In that huge mansion.
Oh, the Whitney?
The Whitney, yeah. It used to be this this lumber baron in this enormous house built like in the 1880s or something like that. Now,
which I heard it's haunted.
Is it really? Yeah. Well, it's a big upscale place. But it's kind of cool. They got free music there on Fridays and all that.
I've never, ever been there.
You can go up there. I mean, the place is so luxurious. And say like a beer that would cost $4 somewhere would cost $5 there.
That's why you probably don't see me there.
Oh, yeah. And you can go around the corner to the Detroit Brew Works.
Oh, the Motor City Brewing Works.
Motor City Brew Works.
You'll find me there.
Yeah, find me there. Great pizza, great homemade beer. Anyway, so there's this riff party, and it's, I'm there to the bitter end. Arthur Panhallo's there to the bitter end. Steve Costan is there when, he was at Riff and all that. And Arthur orders a cognac for, what the hell? I don't want to exaggerate. So it was like, say, $40.
Okay. And this was a long time ago.
It was a while ago. Not a long time ago.
Well, if Costan was still over here, that was a long time ago. Because I've been here for 15, 16 years.
And he wasn't here.
Yes.
Right. Anyway, so Arthur, we ordered, he orders a round for us.
Yeah.
And the restaurant's glad to comply because then they've got more, trade out to spend for ads on our station.
Yeah.
So I said, Arthur, it's near the Cass Corridor, and it was in a time, it was probably in the 80s, so this was when things were pretty shabby down in what's now called Midtown, and then it was called the Cass Corridor.
Yeah.
So I said to Arthur, Arthur, probably right across the street, there's somebody sleeping in a doorway while we're drinking this $40 shot.
I can only imagine his answer.
He said, I'll drink to that.
Oh, God. And I'm not laughing. You know what I mean? I'm not. Yeah. It's just because it's Arthur.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so Arthur.
It is. If people don't know, he was a legendary DJ on this station. And maybe people don't. When you're gone, you're gone,
Everybody remembers him.
Does he?
Okay. He's the one who said, baby.
Baby.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was at a staff meeting one time, and they were saying how that had worn so well over the years. That little, they had bumper sticker, Riff had bumper stickers out that said baby.
Yeah, we still have the bumper stickers.
But I remember one time a consultant to the radio station said, glad you said baby and not like far out or something like
that. I like far out. groovy, that kind of thing.
Groovy. Yeah.
I actually have an original baby T-shirt.
Really?
With that bumper sticker.
Yeah.
But I don't ever wear it because I don't want people to think that I'm like pregnant or something. Not that I look like it.
You'd have to have like an arrow pointing down.
I don't know.
Yeah. T-shirts. Well, there are people that put stuff on T-shirts that I just can't even believe.
I know. Speaking of T-shirts, look at mine. We're talking about bourbon.
Let me see.
Can you see?
Yeah, wow.
Jack Daniel's.
Jack Daniel's. So this is nothing like Pappy Van Winkle, which goes for a shot for $75. And Sheriff Pat Melton of Franklin County, Kentucky, said that the culprit stole almost 200 bottles in 3-bottle cases of Pappy Van Winkle, 20 year. It has a suggested retail price of $130 a bottle, and the 9 cases of cheaper ones. The thief had an obvious motive. The secondary market for the scarce whiskey is hot. A single bottle of 20-year-old Pappy sold at Bonham's Auction in New York on Sunday for $1,200.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah. Sean Brock, an owner of Husk Restaurants in Nashville, said it's the most complex bourbon you've ever tasted, but it's smooth as silk. That's why people go crazy for it.
I bet it is smooth. It better be for that, guys. I'll tell you. This reminds me of the old days of help me. Where are my words tonight?
What are you looking for? Prestidigitate.
No. When it was illegal to drink, prohibition.
Oh, yeah, illegal.
Yeah, all the heists, the liquor heists, and they're going old school there.
There's a great book about prohibition called, and it has to do with these liquors. called Last Call, and it was made into a documentary, which I did not see, done by, what's his name? It does all those great documentaries about the Civil War and all.
We always forget his name every time.
Yeah.
We do this every time.
Have I talked about this book before?
No, but we've tried to remember his name on the show before.
All right. What's his name? The great documentarian. It's all on PBS.
He's awesome. Yeah. He did one about jazz.
Oh, that's right. The jazz one was great.
Yeah.
But anyway, I learned a lot of stuff. For one thing, that the Prohibition movement was the largest social movement of any movement in the history of the country. Bigger than the abolitionists, bigger than the union movement.
Really?
Bigger than all the anti-war movement.
Because it's alcohol. People like to...
No, they want to get rid of it.
They want
to...
Oh, against it!
The Prohibition movement.
Oh, but the drinkers, they just kept drinking, though.
Yeah. And,
really?
Well, it increased. It didn't work.
Right.
Yeah, and... Almost everybody was for it, like the industrial workers of the world, this radical union.
They said pro.
The Ku Klux Klan, on the other hand. I meant it was like across the board.
Yeah,
and the people that didn't want it were essentially were the ethnics, particularly Catholics, Italians, Irish, and what have you. They're drinking.
Well, no doubt.
So drinking used to be pretty much a male thing. And they remember that. You've seen those signs. That the old slogan was that drink is the curse of the working class, whereas, you know, turned it around and said work is the curse of the drinking class.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Well, I remember when I was growing up, I mean, this sounds so pretentious, but trust me, I'm not. At the country club, they had the men's grill.
Yeah.
And, I would always look in there. But I could never step foot in there.
Well, the bars, some of the bars, particularly working class bars, were only inhabited by men, frequented, I guess they say, by men. And they would have, there'd be the bar on one wall and then the urinal on the other wall.
You know, oh my gosh.
Taking it in on one side, letting it out on the other. And the
gross.
Only, and men drank whiskey, right?
That was it?
Yeah. And then, but a lot of the, as we know, a lot of the stuff that came, was available during Prohibition. Some of it was smuggled in from Canada here. People were drinking good Canadian whiskey here. But in other parts, you know, it was hooch and people made it in their backyards. And,
oh, yeah.
And all that. So they actually developed mixed drinks to cover,
the alcohol?
Yeah, to cover the bad alcohol.
Oh, that's how that was created.
Yeah.
And look at the industry that came out of that.
And what big group started drinking during the 1920s?
What, women?
Of which you are an inheritor. Yeah.
Moi.
Yeah, yeah. So women started drinking as well. And
that's
when
things got really fun.
Yeah. And drinking, I mean, you start looking even like $8 or $10 for, I mean, for one thing, I won't do it. These mixed drinks they have now, you know, $8 is cheap. $10, $12,
yeah.
$14. I won't do it.
Now, wait a minute. You're going back on your word. You invited me to go to Andiamo.
Yeah.
I had
a coupon.
And it's expired?
No. I took somebody else. My wife.
You cheater. And she doesn't even drink.
And she does.
You're cheating on me with your wife.
She does drink, but every time she
really
does.
She really doesn't.
She does. But every time she does, she starts fights.
She does not. It hurts her stomach. Peter. Can't fight. Oh, I almost said her word or her name.
I know. We can't say her name.
No.
Or our dog's name either.
We should give him fake names.
We could call her Lulu.
Okay. She is a little Lulu at times.
I know she's not listening. She goes to sleep early.
Yeah.
All right,
talk about her all we want.
Yeah. Let me do this. This is a little late on this. You know, there's always been this debate about animal experimentation, what is the...
Vivisection.
Yeah. Well, there used to be something called the Anti-Vivisection League.
I know.
Which was against cutting up animals to...
For research.
Yeah. Or what we used to do in biology class, we'd cut up frogs.
Oh, that was so disgusting.
Yeah. The guys loved it and the girls would scream.
I didn't touch that thing. I always found a boy to do that
for
me.
Really?
Yeah, I know, it's shocking.
The girls would lean over and we'd snap their bra straps.
Oh, God, that's so old school.
I know.
Oh, my gosh. If a boy did that to a girl now, they'd get slapped.
Slapped? They would be they'd probably be on some sex offender list for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, some kind of lawsuit.
Yeah, without a doubt. Anyway, there's been two decades of experiments at Wayne State University subjecting dogs to invasive, cruel procedures before then they kill the animals. And as part of the medical school, and there's going to be this physicians committee, and they're putting together a peaceful scientist and physician-led demonstration at Wayne State to stop these experiments once and for all. Suzanne, bring your dog. I mean,
I did not know
not
they
to
were,
leave it.
That they did that there.
Not
yeah.
to, don't leave your dog.
Don't
there.
Leave your dog there.
Yeah. The contention is that, and by the people that do it, these scientists and medical researchers don't say, "Oh, I just do it to, love to cut up dogs and abuse."
No,
me.
I know.
They say that there's medical advances. On the other hand, let me see, somewhere in here it says, and there's always this debate whether it does.
Well, but, yeah, a friend of mine works for the National Institute of for Health, NIH, out in D.C., and she invited me one time because I was living in Miami, and there was a convention in Puerto Rico. Well, that's just a little hop and a skip over from Miami. So I went over there, and I go, so, what is this convention about? What is this? And I was Miss PETA back then and a total vegetarian, which, by the way, I am back on the vegetarian train. And really? Stories like this make me want to do that. But she said, oh, this is, it's like animal research. I go, I fly over here. You know where I stand on all of this. And she looked at me and she goes, if you say one word to any of these people about PETA, I'm going to kick you out.
That's people for the ethical treatment of animals. Yeah, most of you probably know that. So you didn't go to any of the sessions. You just sat around and drink rum.
Pina coladas.
Yeah.
Lots of them.
Anyway, there's going to be a demonstration at Wayne State, against Wayne State dog experiments, and they say peaceful demonstration. Why do they even have to say that?
When is it?
Thursday, November 14th at 10:45 a.m.
So you would put that on your website, and we'll remind everyone. That's very important.
Corner of West Kirby and Anthony Wayne Drive, which is 3rd Avenue. And let me see if I can get this page to go down.
Now it's time for cold protesting. I don't look forward to that. But
yeah, I can't seem to get this page down, so we're going to have to just leave it at that. But, there'll be some information there. And, my wife won't let me bring our dog, because now we have a little small dog.
Yeah.
Right?
A very little small dog.
Yeah, right. Well, they have some advantages. I mean, you can pick them up.
Well, the ladies like it, too, when you want
Well,
whoa,
whoa, here, let's see. Let me see. Could this be, I think it could be,
this is
too late.
Email.
It is. It's Ron Paul Rick.
He's back?
He's back.
Is he calling himself Ron Paul Rick?
He does, yeah.
Oh, so, because remember, he rejected Ron Paul, and he said he was done with him, too.
I think he wanted to just make sure. You know, this email is too long, Rick.
It's really long.
It says, let me see, there's a video of Colby, the CIA director, telling Congress that they do have people in the news media manipulating the news. Well, yeah, we knew that.
Yeah.
But if you're looking for some mainstream media news article to confirm Colby's quote, we'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false. He says you won't find it. You know
okay.
what? I think it is a manufactured quote. I don't think it's real. The essence of it is so. And he says, "Come on, Pete.
We're glad you're back."
The director of the CIA was asked by Congress if the NSA is spying on Americans. He said, "No way." Edward Snowden busted him, and he came clean. Now 20 other nations are totally bent out of shape because they found out America is spying on them too. Well, he says, darn well, Rick, come on. I know this is true. I'm saying that we don't have to manufacture these quotes to bolster our contention. Let's see. Aaron from Mount Clemens writes in a call talk, at yahoo.com. You're thinking of the great documentarian Ken Burns.
Thank you. My gosh. Yeah. Now I've got to burn that in my memory. I can remember that guy.
There you go.
That's it.
Did you do that purposely?
I did.
Okay.
Yes.
That's good. Let me see. Although,
that's how I got my college degree, little tricks like that.
Yeah. And let's see. Here, according to someone else sending in something. See, this was on the Internet. Doesn't mean it's so. President John F. Kennedy, 7 days before his assassination. There's a plot in this country to enslave every man, woman, and child. Before I leave this high and noble office, I intend to expose this plot. I've got this radar that knows that this is false.
It's called the BS radar.
It's called a BS radar. I mean...
Well, there's so much out there that like this. And there's just so much, and how do you filter through it and find the truth?
Here's one of the reasons I don't this hops to it. There's no reason to enslave every man, woman, and child. Most of us are pretty passive. We don't challenge the people that are that rule us. We make excuses for them. We worship them. I mean, the whole idea. You know, they're trying to put together a monument for President Eisenhower. A president.
Is this recent?
Yeah.
Okay.
A president ought to have the same respect that we have give to the drain commissioner. In other words, it's a civil servant who's doing a job, and one has more important decisions to make. But why do we worship this? And really, folks, this is something for the conservatives. Like, they want to have monuments in every county in America for Reagan, the guy that destroyed the economy with his economic policies, and we're just reaping the harvest of it today. But regardless, we do not want the adulation of politicians.
Yeah, it's bad enough with celebrities, you know?
Yeah, and it's the same thing. I mean, you can become that. We take it for granted, the Washington Monument, which, people say it looks like something. You know what it looks like to me?
The large...
Yes. You know what it looks like to me? A Klansman.
Ooh, I never thought about that.
Well, it has, it goes up to a pointed tip.
Yeah.
And then at night, it's got two lights that look like eyes.
I'd like to stick with the penis. Not the Klansman.
All right.
You've ruined it for me.
All right. He was the first president. Lincoln freed the slaves. And universally, people... think of Franklin Delano Roosevelt as a monument to him. But, and there's also Mount Rushmore and all that. But, come on, these modern politicians, we don't need to adulate them, do we?
Did they really cover up Mount Rushmore during the shutdown?
Cover it up?
Yeah.
No, that was another writing.
Okay, good. I thought that would be a large cover. I've been there.
Did you know that they have a new dictionary out and gullible is not in it?
Stop it. Right. Yeah, you've tried that one.
I know.
That's an old trick, Werby.
Listen, we're going to say goodnight. I want to appreciate everybody for listening and for calling and for emailing. Oh, you know what I forgot to look at? Hold on. Do we have time to
Our text messages?
Did anybody text us?
Did they?
I think so.
Okay.
Yes.
Really?
I don't know.
Because this is all brand new to us.
Yeah.
This whole, not texting in general, because Peter and I actually, Peter has text messaged before. But as far as the show goes, we are now asking you to text us.
So Christopher from Keego Harbor, you broke us in.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And he writes, Ted Cruz, like Jennifer Granholm, the ex-governor of Michigan, cannot be president because they were born in Canada.
Oh,
that's weird. He's born in Canada. I mean, he could be the same. I figured Cruz, I thought he was like a Mexican-American.
Maybe he's a Mexican-Canadian-American.
There you go. Took the long way around.
Yeah.
All right. I got a lot to research. Maybe I'll post this on our Facebook page, facebook.com/nightcall. All right. Jefferson.
Did you say you will be posting that?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
You or Debbie.
Okay.
All right.
Jefferson, thanks for answering the phones tonight and getting our podcast ready. It'll be up tomorrow.
And if you can believe it, a non-believer, you like that? If you can believe it, a non-believer is going to interview...
A believer.
A believer. Not only that, a Catholic priest, right after these.
He's an awesome
Thanks
dude.
For listening to Night Call on 101 The Riv. We'll return with more Night Call right after this. Night Call. Night Call. WRIF and WRIF HD 1 Detroit.
Oh, you're on!
The Riff. WRIF and WRIF HD 1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. If you've been listening to this program over a period of years, you may have heard me speak about the School of the Americas, a group, an organization called School of the Americas Watch, and the marches to Fort Benning, Georgia, where the School of America is now with a new name since 2000 is located, and the function it has within American foreign policy. The man that put this all together in 1990 is Roy Bourgeois. He was ordained as a Catholic priest in 1972 and has been a member of the Mary Knoll Fathers and Brothers since that time. There's been a lot of changes in his life, and we haven't checked in with him lately. What's happening with the School of the Americas? That just sounds great, doesn't it? The School of the Americas. There's another march happening, as it does annually, November 22nd through the 24th, and you can go to soaw.org. There'll be a link on my website, and I'll repeat all of this again. Right now, it's always a pleasure to welcome Father Roy Bourgeois. We're reaching him in his office in Columbus, Georgia. Welcome back to the broadcast.
It's good to be with you, Peter.
Well, let's see now, but is it still Father Roy Bourgeois? You got booted out.
Well, I poked that beehive of patriarchy. For years I've been poking the beehive at the Pentagon. But no, I was expelled as a Catholic priest after 40 years, which is very painful, because not of my protest against the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, but because of calling for the ordination of women in the Catholic Church. I, like most Catholics, believe that, you know, men and women are created equal, and that women are also being called to serve as priests. My conscience compelled me to speak on that grave injustice much closer to home in my church. And as a result of calling for the ordination of women and gender equality in the Catholic Church, I was warned if I did not recant, I would be expelled from the priesthood in my Mary Knoll community of 46 years. In conscience, I simply wrote the Vatican and simply said, what you're asking me to do is to lie, to say to you that I do not believe that men and women are created equal. This would be a lie. This goes against our faith and teachings of the Catholic Church. I will not recant. As a result, I was expelled about 10 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it still Father Roy Bourgeois, or is it now just Mr.?
Well, there's a little problem because most Catholics, I mean, Catholics are taught, as I am, we are taught when we are ordained, thou art a priest forever. Pope Benedict said that he had dissolved my vows. Well, a man, including the Pope, cannot do that. Those vows that we make are sacred. They're between, you know, the person and God. And someone cannot dissolve one's sacred vows. So when I travel around, I mean, people say to me that I'm still a Catholic priest in, you know, in the church. According to the Vatican, of course, I'm expelled, defrocked. But most Catholics in my travels, I'm getting more invitations, not more now than before, as being expelled, simply because, you know, the vast majority, the New York Times, CBS just recently showed in their poll that 70% of Catholics support the ordination of women. So most Catholics would still refer to me, and I see myself as a priest today.
Well, it's the Catholic Church is not a democratic organization, and no more than if you're a policeman or in the army, that's the way it goes. It's top down. So
exactly, and that's sort of the core of the crisis. You know, the problem, really. I mean, it took me a while to see this injustice. You know, I got my calling when I was in Vietnam, a young man in the military. And what I heard, you know, in my ministry over the years, I met many devout Catholic women who shared with me their faith and their call. And what I heard really kept me awake at night. I mean, we do profess as Catholics that, you know, men and women are created by a loving God. We are created equal. And Catholic priests all say that the call to be a priest comes from God. So the question I began to ask myself and my fellow priests was a basic one. Who are we as men to say that our call from God is authentic, but God's call of women is not? And I simply realized, too, that this problem really is not with God. The problem is with an all-clerical male culture you know, men who dominate the church have been dominating the church for centuries. The problem is with this all-male priesthood who would view women as lesser than men and really would see women as a threat to our power.
Hmm. My guest is Father Roy Bourgeois. We'll give him the title that he bore for so many years, over 40 years. And the release from the Vatican said that his disobedience in preaching against the teaching of the Catholic Church about women's ordination, meaning making them priests, led to his excommunication, dismissal, and boy, that's a hard laization, right? Is that, the correct? Well, you've had an incredible life. You were in the United States Navy at the time of Vietnam. You were an officer for 4 years. You spent 2 years at sea. You were did two tours of duty, one in Vietnam, and in the first you were actually wounded and received the Purple Heart. And then you entered the priesthood. Is there a connection? I mean, why What was there any connection between Vietnam and a decision to become a Catholic priest?
Without a doubt. I mean, I was, I grew up in a small town in Louisiana. We didn't question church teachings or U.S. foreign policy. When I left college, Vietnam was on being patriotic. And as a Catholic, we were encouraged, of course, to serve in the military when your country needed you. And so I entered the military, thought of making it a career. But really, the experience in Vietnam was that turning point in my life, Peter. I mean, the violence, the suffering there, really, I'd never seen such madness. But it was really the civilians, especially children at this nearby orphanage, that really began to force me to question what I was doing there. I came to the conclusion, as so many, many coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan, we are not made for war. And it was in Vietnam, in the midst of the violence and suffering and death, and losing friends there, that I began to feel called to be a priest. My faith became much more important. Death was very close. God became closer in my life. And when I left Vietnam, I entered the Marino Fathers and Brothers, you know, a group that works with the poorest of the poor in Africa, Asia, Latin America. I was ordained in 1972, and then sent to serve the poor of Bolivia that became my home for the next 5 years. And it was here in Bolivia that I was introduced to U.S. foreign policy. Our country was supporting a brutal dictator there, General Hugo Banzer. He and his men with the guns were oppressing the poor that I lived with, who grew to love. And they became my teachers, the poor. And really, it was in my fifth year when the repression intensified. Many were killed, including a well-known Jesuit priest there, Luis Espinal. Many imprisoned. I was among the many arrested, and because I was a U.S. citizen, I was forced out of the country and became, shortly after that, very involved in the School of the Americas issue.
Yeah, and we want to, pardon me, talk about the School of the Americas, which is actually a training, military training center at Fort Benning, Georgia. And my guest, Roy Bourgeois, founded the School of the Americas Watch in 1990. There's been yearly marches, and I'm probably holding people too much in suspense as to why there are marches there. But you can go to SOAW.org, and I just noticed there's also a website, My Journey from Silence to Solidarity. It's RoyBourgeoisJourney.org. Every time I try to write Bourgeois, my spell check comes on. So what I'm going to, if people are better than me, they can go right to it. If not, they can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. I will have a link to that and also to the SOAW.org website. Now, the School of the Americas, the idea was, as it's said, put out publicly, to give the troops of our Latin American allies the kind of training they would need to suppress, I'm trying to put the best face on it. Why bother? Tell me about the School of the Americas and how the School of the Americas Watch came to be.
Well, I must say it was the School of the Americas began way back in the 1940s, perhaps well-intentioned by our U.S. Congress, who passed a resolution saying, they started up the School of the Americas in Panama to train all of these soldiers from Latin America. They said to bring stability to Latin America. However, in the 60s, 70s, throughout the 80s, we began to support dictators, all in the name of fighting communism, Marxism. And really, in 1984, the school was forced out of Panama and quietly settled at Fort Benning, Georgia, the U.S. Army School of the Americas, all paid for by our tax money. It was hiding really behind this wall of secrecy, Peter, for years. We didn't find out about it until after Bishop Oscar Romero was assassinated in El Salvador. Four church women, two of them good friends, Maronite nuns, Maura Clark and Anita Ford, and the two Ursuline members, when they were raped and killed in El Salvador in 1980, this is when a congressional task force actually went to investigate after the massacre also of six Jesuit priests in 1989, along with the young mother and there and her 15-year-old daughter. But a U.S. congressional task force, after the massacre of the six Jesuits and the two women, reported that those responsible for this massacre were trained at the U.S. Army School of the Americas at Fort Benning. That's when I and a small group came here to investigate the school, and what we found was very serious. A school that had trained over 50,000 soldiers over the years, and it was now operating in our backyard at Fort Benning in Georgia. And really, it was all about counterinsurgency. And we asked, of course, who were the insurgents? And what we learned, they were the poor, the landless farmers in El Salvador, Colombia, where most of the soldiers are coming from today, in Bolivia and elsewhere. They are the religious leaders who try to speak out for the poor, the labor leaders, especially in Colombia today. And that's why the United Auto Workers and union labor leaders are in our movement. They are healthcare workers and university students. And really, when it was reported by the United Nations Truth Commission report also, that those who killed Bishop Romero, raped the church women, killed the Jesuits, and the list went on and on, were trained here at the school, that's when we really started the SOA Watch movement. And we simply put out the word, let us gather here every November, that weekend before Thanksgiving, and keep alive the memories of the thousands killed in these countries, all in our name, with our tax money, by training these thugs coming from these countries, being trained in combat skills, and many in our movement, I must say, are veterans, Vietnam vets, Iraq vets, those coming back from Afghanistan. This school, really, the millions being pumped into this school when we're talking about budget cuts, I mean, it's a scandal. It's a theft from the two schools that just recently closed right here in Columbus, Georgia, right near Fort Benning, where the school is located. Two middle schools have shut down simply because they didn't have the funds to keep them open. So those students had to go into a more crowded school now.
It's absolutely incredible that we are spending our tax dollars to train troops from other countries who aren't certainly aren't at risk from war. So it only can be for internal suppression. If you want more on this, you can go to SOAW.org. It's School of the Americas Watch.org. I'm interviewing the founder, Roy Bourgeois, who for 40 years was a Maronite priest, was recently, or just the last year, expelled for his advocacy of the ordination of women. And I know Bob King, the president of the UAW, he always, even before he was president here in Detroit, always took down a contingent. And you mentioned union leaders. I assume that he's still involved.
Very much so. Bob, he started coming, he and a small group of the United Auto Workers years ago before he was elected president. And he was here last year. I think he will be coming with many union leaders this year. He has spoken from our stage when we have, 15, 20,000 gathered here. And what he has shown his solidarity and expressed his support for our movement. They are making a connection, of course, to the many union leaders killed in Colombia. There are more union leaders killed in Colombia than any other country. So union workers here, like Bob King, the leader of the United Auto Workers, you know, wants to show solidarity with the union leaders of these countries and making a connection to the U.S. Army School of the Americas.
Right. I have to say that going there, and I count back the years, I was there in November 2001, just almost, you know, 2 months after 9/11, which was extraordinarily moving. And, you know, being a tough guy, I rarely shed any tears. But when they started a ceremony of naming the people that had been victims of the graduates, if you will, of the School of the Americas, Latin American troops, and each time said presente, that their spirit still remains and are present, tears were coming down my face. And I'm not a religious person, and yet the kind of spiritual connection, if you will, that all of us had, regardless of one's religion or lack of it, is palpable. It's an incredible event, and I was thinking, why haven't I gone back?
Yeah, let me just mention that for our listeners. I mean, it's a very spiritual experience, as you mentioned. And, I mean, we started with a small group of nuns and Catholic priests who had worked with the poor of Latin America. Our movement, really, I mean, it's made up of many faith traditions, people who come, really, in the name of solidarity, to be, you know, to walk with others in their struggle and to close a school that really is all paid for by our tax money, and really what's going on is untold suffering and death in these countries by our country. It's all about exploiting cheap labor and those vast natural resources. So we come here, Saturdays, filled with a lot of speakers from Latin America, from the U.S., lots of musicians come, and workshops take place at night in the convention center, teach-ins, and Sunday it's much more solemn. Thousands carry the photos of the victims, small white crosses bearing the names of the victims and their ages, many of them children. And as we process by the thousands to the main gate of Fort Benning, the names of the victims are called out. And after each name comes presente. And it's here that I think we're touching on the sacred. And people of all different faiths, you know, and backgrounds, I would say over half who gather here are college students and high school students, which really makes us happy to see the youth involved. It's kind of their connection to Latin America. And as the names are called, many weep. I do also. And when we get to the fence of Fort Benning, we put the crosses, photographs on that fence, and we turn it into a memorial wall. Also, I want to say that really on the fence there's a big sign that said no trespassing. It's topped with barbed wire. Reminds me of some of the prisons I've been into, as many of us have, for protesting the school. They try to say to us that they're teaching democracy at the school. Well, you know, we go to Latin America today, and, I mean, this school is well-known in these countries. I'm happy to report that six countries have pulled out: Argentina, Uruguay, Bolivia, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Nicaragua. We've met with their presidents, and we were very happy when their presidents made a decision to pull their countries out of this school, simply saying this school has caused too much suffering and death to their people. I'm happy to report, too, that we have a bill in Congress, Peter, H.R., House Resolution 2989, H.R. 2989, and it's very important, I think, for our listeners to contact members of Congress. And the bill was just introduced 3 weeks ago, and we've got a respectable number, but really, calls, emails, contacting members of Congress with the message, we don't want our money going into this school.
I was going
to direct that money to schools for our children.
Yeah, I was going to say that I'm sure that it's implied, but we wanted to make it clear. The demand is close the School of the Americas at Fort Benning in Columbus, Georgia. And the event this year, the week before Thanksgiving, is November 22nd through the 24th, or And you can go to soaw.org. My guest on the Peter Werbe Show is the founder father, Roy Bourgeois. I want to repeat this information. I want to go back a little to your experience with the church. You were indicating it centuries of history, and much of it is not, one doesn't find a very pleasant reporting if we think about the Inquisition and the Crusades and the witch burning and all of that. And now you are expelled for simply advocating the ordination of women. Why does Roy Bourgeois stick with the Catholic Church? I mean, there's tons of others. I mean, in fact, there was a whole movement called the Reformation that said, we're out of here. We're going to become Presbyterians and Methodists and the rest of that. Why, given its history, stick with the Catholic Church?
That's a good question. I mean, I really thought seriously of leaving, but and many of my friends have. They just couldn't take it anymore, especially women friends. They said they felt invisible in church. They got so angry, you know, with the language. You know, they're just excluded. Of course, the sexual abuse scandal really rocked the church to its foundation. But I felt, today I feel like these many women who are being called to be ordained. Some have left and pursued their call in other churches. I meet them all the time. But many of these women are staying in the church, as I am, to work for change and reform. I felt if I left, I never did like bullies. I have to tell you, I don't like people who abuse power. I saw it in Latin America through dictators who just didn't, they became addicted to power. It saddens me to say this, but so many church leaders at the Vatican, bishops in the U.S., they have become addicted to power. They abuse their power. They beat up on people. And really, they do everything they can not to bring about, you know, this gender equality and equality for our LGBT members in the church. I mean, they're discriminated against, and they cause great suffering. Well, if I left, it kind of allows them to keep beating up on people, causing suffering, as I saw in Latin America. And I refuse to leave. I'm staying in, and the message is clear. I mean, most Catholics want change in the church, and most Catholics realize that the crisis is really men who are claiming ownership of the church, who are saying to us, you know, members of the church, that only they, and they say this to the nuns, only they can interpret the Holy Scriptures and speak for God. Well, this is heresy. I mean, really, what also hurt very, very deeply was in the letter I got from the Vatican. They said, I was causing grave scandal in the church.
Yeah.
Calling for the ordination of women. Well, I wrote back and I said, you know, when Catholics hear the word scandal, they don't think of the ordination of women. They think of, you know, the over 5,000 Catholic priests in the United States who raped and sexually abused over 12,000 children.
Can we
and
do
the
this?
Bishops who covered up their crimes. This is what Catholics think about.
You know, I wanted to get, and this is very important, and we've got about a minute and a half left. Pope Francis, is that going to create any difference, do you think?
Well, only if he changes church's teachings. I mean, if the church continues to teach that women are inferior, that women cannot hold positions of authority in the church, if the Catholic Church continues to teach, which is the most cruel of all teachings on homosexuality, and the suffering really that this teaching causes, if the Catholic Church does not teach, it changes teachings on women, and, you know, the ordination of women, allowing women to be ordained as equals, and changes teachings really calling for the equality of our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters, the Catholic Church will go the way of the dinosaurs.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on my show again. My guest has been Father Roy Bourgeois. For 40 years, a Marinole priest stripped of his priesthood by the Vatican because of his advocacy of the ordination of women. He's the founder of the School of the Americas Watch. This is a military training center, pardon me, at Fort Benning, Georgia, in Columbus, Georgia, where we're reaching him. And there is annual marches. November 22nd, 24th is the date this year. And Bob King, the president of the UAW, is going to be down there. Many people from Michigan. You can go to soaw.org. And there's also a website, My Journey from Silence to Solidarity, which is roybourgeoisjourney.org. There's a lot there. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, NightCallRadio.com. I'll have links to all of this. Father Roy, as usual, thanks for being on the broadcast.
Great to be with you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to Night Call on 101 The Rib. Peter will be back with another guest in just a moment. Night Call. Night Call.
What you're supposed to do to take care of your tires by Mike Rowe. You know, I don't really know what you're supposed to do. You know who does, though? The tire experts in the service department at your Ford dealership.
Get up to $140 in mail-in rebates on four select tires when you use the Ford Service Credit Card. Click on the banner now. Subject to credit approval, rebates by check. Other tire manufacturer rebate or offer cannot be combined with Ford Service Credit Card rebate or offer. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 12/31/13.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit. Night Call is back on 101 WRIF. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Ah, boy. You know, history, what's the old thing? If you don't learn from it, you're condemned to repeat it. Well, we do it over and over again. And usually we're thinking about negative lessons, but there's some positive ones through history as well. The way ordinary people like you and me have made history. And if you don't think I'm an ordinary person because I'm a media guy, then people like you have made history throughout the world, throughout the world's history, to be sure. And some of you have listened for a long, long time, may remember that about 11 years ago, there was a wonderful book that came out called Three Strikes. And it was about three strikes that were very significant in, well, a lot of their different aspects. Howard Zinn wrote one, the great late historian. Another one was put together by Robin D.G. Kelly, the story of a movie theater's musician strike in New York. And the one, the author that I interviewed was the third strike, and that was Dana Frank. And she brought to light this little-known sit-in, sit-down strike that was conducted by what were called counter girls. And guess where it was? Woodward Avenue and Grand River Avenue. It was during the Great Depression. It was 1937. And Detroit, of course, was much different all those years ago. 75 years, I guess it is now. And it was the center. It was downtown. The suburbs were nada. And people came downtown to go to Hudson's and go to Crowley's and go to Woolworth's as well. And now out in a pamphlet, Women Strikers Occupy Chain Store Win Big, the 1937 Woolworth sit-down. And my guest is Dana Frank. She's a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and the founder of the UCSC Center for Labor Studies. And it's a pleasure to welcome back after quite a few years, Dana Frank. Hi, Dana.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe is it possible to paint a picture of what it was like 75 years ago in downtown Detroit?
Well, certainly, as you say, there wasn't out there, we didn't have the suburbs in the same way, and working class people would go downtown to shop, and one of the big places they would go was the Woolworth store. And Woolworth, you know, used to be the place that everybody knew about. It was sort of basically the Walmart of the early 20th century. It was a chain that was all around the country, and it pioneered selling a lot of cheap stuff at low prices and bringing working class people in to shop, and it also pioneered in exploiting workers around the world that it could buy those products from at cheap things, and people would go down there. You know, that was a basic place where you'd go to buy your pie plates, your shoelaces, things for sewing, things like that.
And you'd take the streetcar down from the east side and the west side down Woodward Avenue, which the streetcar sold off to Mexico City in the 1950s. You'd meet under the clock at Kern's and then go over to Woolworth's, and it all seemed very, very happy. But tell us about 1937 as well. There was a few things going on. There was certainly an economic and political context in which this all fit.
Well, of course, it seemed very happy, but I think people could see that those women, the women that were working at Woolworth's, had an exhausted look in their eye. Well, in 1937 in Detroit was a very massive historic moment. In fact, one of the most important moments in the 20th century, and people from Detroit should be very proud of this. It was way in the depths of the Great Depression, and in the middle of that, that's when the United Auto Workers was formed, and they had a famous sit-down strike that started in December of 1936 and went into early 1937. When they occupied part of a General Motors plant and shut down General Motors in the entire country and had this huge victory that really had massive ripple effects ever since in the labor movement and people's sense of what was possible. And those auto workers did it because they occupied the plant, one particular plant that was strategically important to the whole production of General Motors. And, you know, I think people know about normal strikes where you have a lot of people outside, you try to get as many people as possible with picket signs, and you try to keep it so that no strike breakers or scabs can get in, and that's how you shut for diamond production or whatever kind of work is going on in that place, and that's how you win. Then people started experimenting with sit-down strikes in the 30s, and General Motors was the most famous one, and they sat down, and because they had public opinion on their side, because the police weren't quite, the police chief wasn't quite going to beat them up, because the government was, the governor was sort of not willing to send in the troops, and people had a sense that, you know, there was something very wrong in U.S. society in that, in the depths of the Great Depression, so they had public opinion on their side. And they won this huge victory over General Motors in February of 1937, and nobody could believe it. It's like beating the biggest corporation in the whole world in the middle of a depression. And because of that, people in Detroit started thinking about, okay, what can we do?
These were, simple, not only were they, as they were called, counter girls, and probably, what do you think they were making? 25 cents an hour, maybe something like that?
Yeah, I mean, you can do those things, and it doesn't really translate into dollars now. The main thing is it wasn't enough to live on if you weren't already living with your family.
But these were teenagers, right? Essentially, 18, 19?
They were mostly some late teenagers, early 20s, and that's why they're called counter girls, but... Of course, that was part of thinking of women as children, you know, like calling the 60-year-old secretary a girl. These women, they worked 12, you know, very long hours, very long weeks. They never got to sit down. They were very exhausted. They were deliberately hired with high turnover and treated poorly by management so that they would quit, so they never had to give anybody a raise. It was the same formula that you see like at, you know, Target or you know, any of these stores, Walmart. You have a really high turnover, and then you don't ever have to give anybody a raise, and you make it so the job is very, very low skill so that you can just hire anybody off the street. And that formula was pioneered in part by Woolworths in the early 20th century. What's really interesting is that these women decided, they were very regular women. They were 100 young women. And the headline here is that these 100 young women sat down and occupied a Woolworth store, that Woolworth store in downtown Detroit, for an entire week and won all their demands at the end of the week. And also another Woolworth store, and sorry I don't have the location off the top of my head, they also shut down after 4 days. So it's a really amazing story. But it wasn't even just about Woolworth, because there were lots of little so-called quickie sit-downs after the big General Motors strike and before the Woolworth strike. All these workers, like in a golf ball factory, in a place that served lunches, in restaurants, in all sorts of little tiny factories and workplaces in Detroit, people would just sort of sit down for 3 hours and win all their demands because management was terrified because they thought, gee, anything could happen here, right? So it was this sort of incredible historical moment that's hard to imagine now, but if people think about Occupy Wall Street, you realize that people can get ideas really fast and things can mushroom. And that's what happened at Woolworth.
Way before social media as well. My guest is Dana Frank, and she's a professor of history at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Her account of the 1937 Woolworth sit-down strike has been republished as Women Strikers Occupy Chain Store Win Big, and it's published by Haymarket Books. You can go to haymarketbooks.org. You can see it on my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, .com. And when every once in a while I'll get email, the subject line will say, "Remember when?" And it'll be this sort of white nostalgia of what Detroit was 50 and 75 years ago, a city that appeared to be, it was predominantly white, and African Americans were really out at the margins of it all. And tell me, in terms of the Woolworth strike in 1937, who these young women were, like ethnically, and was there any homogeneity to them in terms other than that they were all white?
Well, you know, I've been trying to figure out who these women were. I spent a lot of time on that. From everything I can tell, all those women were white. And that was because Woolworths had very explicit racist hiring practices, not because there weren't black people in Detroit that wanted to and could have done a great job of working there. There was very clearly a lot of discrimination at Woolworths. And, of course, later in the early 1960s, that's when you get the famous sit-downs of the lunch counters at Woolworths all over the South, because Woolworths also refused to serve African-American patrons at its famous lunch counters. So there's a long racial politics of Woolworths stores. As far as we know, these women were all white, although there are stories of light-skinned black women passing for white to work in department stores in this period. But it's really important to understand that Woolworths was really very explicitly whites-only place, both in terms of working there and in terms of shopping there in the 1930s.
Dana Frank, did you ever find any of these women? I mean, they would probably...
I worked very hard. No, I never found any of them. I tried phone books. I tried everything. I did find, through my mother and the League of Women Voters, down where she lives in California, I found a woman who had worked in that store about a few months before, and she told me what it was like to work there, and she worked there when she was 15 or 16. That's the closest I ever came. So anyone had a grandmother out there that worked at Woolworths in 1937? You know, there was a Woolworths strike in earlier than this one in New York City, and if you read Shelley Winters' autobiography, the famous actress Shelley Winters, she actually talks about being a Woolworths striker in her autobiography, but I didn't find that until after the book came out.
You know, it's interesting because particularly when you did the work on this, I assume in the late 1990s, a lot of these women would have who were counter girls then would have been women in their late 70s, and many of them probably are alive today. But you know, when I interviewed you in 2001, you explicitly put out a call asking if anybody remembered the 1937 Woolworth sit-down strike at the Woolworths at the corner of Woodward and Grand River to please get a hold of you, and I'm assuming that
nobody called me. I did, if you look in the text, I mean, I did find two people that visited the picket line, if you look in there.
Mm-hmm.
I did track them down, and they're in the epilogue as well. And then, the story of the research on this is really interesting because we just don't have these kind of stories because you have to have the sources to do it. And one of the reasons that I was able to tell the story with so much detail is because the media was all over the story. It was on the cover of all the newspapers all over the country, not just in Detroit. And Life magazine, the really famous picture magazine, went down there, and there was a newsreel, which was, you know, before we had YouTube, there were video and television. There were newsreels, movie newsreels would go down there and film it, and that's how I was able to have all those details. And then we also have some autobiographical stuff that was written later by two of the union organizers. So it's we don't take for granted that we even know these stories, because they can just disappear, and people wouldn't know that these 100 young women, absolutely ordinary young women with no history, as far as we can tell, of union activity, did this incredibly daring thing. They occupied a store all by themselves for a week and won all their demands. They got a 25% pay raise. They got time and a half for overtime. They got free uniforms, which they'd had to pay for by themselves. And the most amazing thing is they even got paid 50% pay for all the time they'd been occupying the store. Now, that's my idea of a victory.
Well, the old industrial workers of the world, which actually still exist, they say direct action brings you satisfaction. Dana Frank, tell us about this, though, because there's so many little aspects to this. There was a popular song at the time that had one of the lyrics, I met my million-dollar baby at a five-and-ten-cent store. Pick up on that. Tell me what that's
about.
Well,
you know, people probably may remember the film a few years ago, Million Dollar Baby, where it comes from. And that song, which Bing Crosby made famous, was the Million Dollar Baby was Barbara Hutton, who was the famous Woolworth heiress who had inherited a big chunk of the Woolworth fortune and was famous for being this sort of the super rich girl. In fact, the phrase poor little rich girl was also coined about Barbara Hutton, and she was this symbol of excess wealth during the Depression. She came into her fortune in the early 30s, and she spent it just, you know, 1,000 different expensive cars. She had this wedding with just the most spectacular, display of obscene wealth you can imagine, and it was all over the newspapers during the 1930s. She actually eventually married royalty like 5 times, and I mean, she's a sort of famous splay your money around rich figure, and who was obviously kind of messed up psychologically too, because she needed to do it. She was a symbol of this kind of absolutely out of control excess wealth in the 1930s, and she was the Woolworth fortune heiress. So she was contrasted in the public imagination to these tired young white women working in the stores who were exhausted and exploited by Woolworths. And, of course, she was rich because they were poor. That's where her wealth came from the exploitation of those women, as well as from the exploitation of the people that were making the products that were sold at Woolworths. So the song goes, I met a million-dollar baby in a 5- and 10-cent store. So the 5- and 10-cent store is the Woolworths, and the million-dollar baby in this is Barbara Hutton. And so that sort of, that contrast was embedded in the popular imagination long before the Woolworths strike, which was part of why the Woolworths strikers got so much public sympathy, which was part of why they could pull it off. So, you know, we hear the phrase million-dollar baby, we don't even realize that it goes back to these Woolworths strikers.
Absolutely incredible. Dana Frank is my guest. She's written Women Strikers, Occupy, Chain Store, Win Big. It's the story of the Detroit 1937 Woolworths sit-down, and it's available from Haymarket Books, haymarketbooks.org. I'm Peter Werby. Thank you all for joining me. And there's so many other aspects, and let's pick up on some of the other themes that you mentioned. At the beginning of this, you were comparing Woolworths to firms like Walmart and Target and what have you. Could you give us just a quick sketch of Woolworth? Because I said in sort of the iconography, if you will, of nostalgia for what Detroit was, you know, Woolworth is just this wonderful place where you could go get a soda and then, as you said, go get some shoelaces for a nickel. So its image is extraordinarily positive in the common memory for the people who have a memory of it.
Well, first of all, we have to remember that is a common memory for white people, and black people, for it was very painful because they couldn't go in there and they couldn't work there. So it had a very deep symbolic meaning. Now, this is not just about Detroit. Woolworths was all over the country, and it was segregated in the South, and black people weren't hired in the North even. So, you know, it's important to say who's the we that even remembers it with nostalgia. But certainly it was like the classic, you know, we think of it as like, gee, the hokey old-time nostalgic store, when actually in the 20s and 30s, Woolworth was the modernizer. Woolworth was the chain store bulldozer like Walmart or Costco destroying small businesses. And, you know, Woolworth was the one that pioneered economies of scale where you buy things in bulk and then you're able to sell them at low prices. But it also destroyed a lot of small businesses. So it's sort of this general, you know, in 20 years, is it all going to be nostalgia for Walmart? So something even more evil and enormous will come along. But what's interesting is there was also a movement against these chain stores. And it wasn't just Woolworth. Woolworth was the biggest one. But there were also supermarket chains that were taking out small grocery stores as well in the neighborhoods. There was actually a whole movement in the 30s against what was known as the chain store evil. I love that phrase, the chain store evil. And there was even a law against that was passed in Congress called the Robinson-Patman Act against chain stores that was little unconstitutional, but it's sort of Walmart, Woolworths, which we think of as the romantic, nice old thing, was actually the sort of bulldozing modernizer destroying other small businesses.
Now, also, you mentioned sort of a parallel between the 1937 Woolworths sit-down strike in Detroit, where the counter girls, the young women there, actually won after a sit-down strike. Let me get a parenthesis in here. You know, it was called, in that era, the sit-down strike, right? People remained made famous, of course, by the UAW workers who sat down in the General Motors plant. But, and as you said, there were literally hundreds, if not thousands, of sit-down strikes in the late 1930s. I'm kind of weaving too far around. I can't remember what the sentence or the parenthesis was. But you were mentioning the parallel between the Occupy movement and the sit-down strikes that just sort of swept. I guess that's where I was going. Swept the nation.
Well, you know, it's like there's some parallels here and there's some distinctions. You know, a sit-down strike isn't about let's take this over and own this. Let's seize this. It's really about a tactic as part of a strike by workers in a particular workplace. And that's what it was, as opposed to a strike where you would be outside the place of employment and picketing and keeping out the scabs, the strike breakers. So, you know, it's a very particular tactic used by workers to get even more power under the right circumstances, because, of course, you can get in a lot of trouble because you are occupying private property. So it depends on public opinion and on the role of the police and local government of what's going to happen. The Occupy movement has a lot of parallels. I mean, it is about this kind of spreading like wildfire, ordinary people just sitting down and occupying something. I mean, the Occupy movement is about occupying public space or sometimes privatized public space in the case of New York, and saying we're just going to sit here, we're going to use our bodies, and we're going to challenge the larger distribution of wealth and the larger politics of our society in this sort of mass movement that spreads quickly. So it is about occupying a space. It's about people using their bodies. The demands are different, but there's a really big similarity between 1937 and Detroit and what's been happening with Occupy Wall Street, in that you suddenly have a historic moment where people are outraged about gaps between rich and poor. They're outraged that in a time of economic downturn, people are getting richer and richer. They're outraged at people losing their jobs. They're outraged at the lack of response by the government. And so they have this outrage that they're putting into their Occupy thing. But also they have a sense of daring, because they also understand that because of that moment, that public opinion is on their side and they can do things that wouldn't otherwise be possible. But in the case of these Woolworths, they're not actually trying to seize anything. They're using it as a tactic, saying, we're not going to get out of here until you actually recognize our union and meet some of our demands.
What came out of the late 30s sit-down movement, though, was a permanent institution of an apparatus that defended worker standards of living for ordinary working people and what have you. So far, the Occupy movement has been, although it still exists here in Detroit, it's pretty much been dispersed from public view.
Well, you know, as a historian, I think that dispersal goes into other channels. I think we don't really know what's going to happen next. It could erupt tomorrow into something spectacular, or those people are learning lessons and taking it into other forms. In the case of the 1930s, both in the case of auto workers and in course of retail clerks, they went on to do all kinds of huge organizing and build these big labor organizations that for decades and decades up to this day won all kinds of institutionalized gains for working peoples, including, you know, vacations with pay, health insurance, not just wages. And I think Occupy has had different goals, and I think they're working through how do you actually get power, and also how do you not just be co-opted into somebody just sort of getting elected and then selling out your demands. So I think that Occupy is even more experimental. And also Occupy has been, through democratic processes, trying to think about how do you connect the dots of a lot of different issues, whereas the General Motors and Woolworths strikes were very focused, which gave them power, but they weren't taking on as much as the Occupy movement is.
I mentioned earlier that Dana Frank's pamphlet, Women Strikers Occupy Chain Store, Win Big, about the Detroit 1937 Woolworths sit-down strike, was part of a Haymarket Books, a pamphlet series. You can go to haymarketbooks.org. Also have another one by the incredible essayist Mike Davis, Be Realistic, Demand the Impossible. That's a slogan from Paris, 1968. And also Francis Fox Piven's Lessons for Our Struggle. Piven, identified as the arch enemy by Glenn Beck, so that makes it worth reading for me just for that. But we just have a minute or so left with Dana Frank, and it's a wonderful pamphlet, because on the cover are six young women, the counter girls, if you will, at Woolworths, and they just all have these smiles. There are grandmothers, maybe in some cases our great-grandmothers' age, and yet it didn't have a happy ending, did it?
Well, they themselves lost their contract after 6 months, but depends on how you define a happy ending, because that strike led to contracts by retail clerks in all the big department stores all over the country that are still there to this day. So again, sometimes the particular people that do something aren't the one that immediately benefited, but it's part of a larger building of the labor movement in stores and also in all kinds of workplaces in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and up to this day. So they were part of that giant, the ripple effects of successes that did lead to contract all through in all Woolworth stores. There were like 40 Woolworth stores in New York City, for example, got a contract and kept the contract for a long time. So it doesn't, they themselves did not keep that contract at more than 6 months, but that doesn't mean that it didn't have huge and positive ripple effects. And also, I do want to say we haven't had a chance to talk about the fact that these were women, and the media treated them like they were just silly girls playing strike, and they kept calling them girls instead of women. I mean, some of them were girls, but they kept sort of seeing that they were just in here playing strike, and they were doing nothing but thinking about their boyfriends. And when actually they were very smart, they were very savvy, they knew what they were doing, and they were very brave, and they did something that almost nobody had ever done, and it was a huge victory. And it's really important to claim these women's militants, especially in the face that everyone wanted to treat them like silly girls playing strike, although in some ways they were so smart, they knew how to use that to protect themselves. Because if they were just silly girls playing strike, it would look really bad if the police came in and pulled them out by their hair.
Hmm. And the one name that I remember from the restaurant workers.
Hotel and restaurant employees.
Was Myra Wolfgang, one of Detroit's great labor leaders. But she comes along a little after this.
Well, she came in, like, you know, the second day of the strike, after the women themselves went out on strike. Her name was Mira Komorowski at the time. And she was really like a very driving force in this strike. But then she and the women, for that matter, to a certain extent, got pushed aside by male leaders from the cooks union and the retail clerks, who had decided that they knew how to run the show. And this is tricky because the women who went out on strike, they needed that help. They needed that solidarity from people with more experience in the labor movement. But one of the bad sides of the story is that those rank and file women also lost control over the negotiating process by the end. So, you know, which brings up this theme of union democracy. If we're going to build these movements, we always have to pay attention to democratic practices, and we also have to pay attention to the gender politics and racial politics of that.
Absolutely incredible story, and not only is it just a story worth reading in and of itself, it has a lot to tell us about what we're doing today. The pamphlet is Women Strikers Occupy Chain Store Win Big. It's the story of the 1937 Detroit Woolworths sit-down strike. I was just down there thinking about this. Woodward and Grand River in downtown Detroit. My guest has been Dana Frank, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and you can find all this at haymarketbooks.org. You can go to my website as well, peterwerby.com. Dana Frank, thanks for being on my show.
Thanks so much, and thanks for bringing back the story.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or sponsors of WRIF Radio or of its parent company, Greater Media Incorporated. Stay tuned. There's more rock coming right up on 101 WRIF, everything that rocks. Night Call. Night Call.
What you're supposed to do to take care of your tires, by Mike Rowe. You know, I don't really know what you're supposed to do. You know who does, though? The tire experts in the service department at your Ford dealership.
Get up to $140 in mail-in rebates on 4 select tires when you use the Ford Service Credit Card. Click on the banner now. Subject to credit approval, rebates by check. Other tire manufacturer rebate or offer cannot be combined or Ford Service Credit Card rebate or offer. See your participating Ford dealer for rebate details through 12/31/13.
Do you owe the IRS? Do you have unfiled tax returns? Have you received a wage garnishment or bank levy? Maybe a lien has been filed against you. OMG Tax can help you with all your IRS tax problems. Don't wait another second. Take action now. Call my team at OMG Tax. Honest and professional, we don't make false promises. If you owe back taxes or the IRS is garnishing your paycheck, you need help now. OMG Tax can help you get your life back to normal. If you're serious about handling your tax matter, call OMG Tax now and get the peace of mind you deserve. Don't let the IRS take your next paycheck. Stop waiting and call our team at OMG Tax. OMG Tax has a straightforward, no-nonsense approach and has helped many Americans resolve their IRS nightmare. Call OMG Tax now.
Call 1-800-430-5474. That's 1-800-430-5474. 800-430-5474.
More Riff Rock now.
101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Thank you.
let go, don't wanna argue anymore. I can't be sure I know just what we're fighting for. I know you're scared and that you're thinking I may go. I'm not leaving, I'm not leaving. And if you're thinking I might, might be led astray, just remember this one question.
HD1 Detroit.
Bring that moment of freak out.
Everything that rocks.